Ranger or Burger.
Good afternoon. We're going to start the House Commerce Committee hearing. We're just waiting on a quorum, but I do want to get our meeting started. We've got a big day ahead of us and want to be respectful of everybody's time. Just a roadmap for the day. We are going to take up three bills before the end of our scheduled end time at 4. So House File 90, House File 1340, and House File 766. My intention is that we will hear testimony, vote on all of those bills. We will then recess and reconvene at 7 p.m. to take up House File 12. And the reconvening will be here in this room. We're expecting a large crowd, and so the sergeant's office has distributed tickets to get into the room. And overflow seating will be available in room 181. Just wanted everybody to have that roadmap for today. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't take up minutes. But I would like Representative Schultz to begin by introducing her bill. And we will have official action on that bill once we get our quorum in place, Representative. Representative Schultz, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 90, which I'm calling the Elder Care Bill. This is the fourth committee stop for the bill. I'm going to briefly go through what I think is relevant to the Commerce Committee in this bill, since it's a rather large bill. So this is a response to the multitude of stories you've already heard about families who had experienced horrific and unthinkable abuse of older and vulnerable adults living in assisted living establishments and nursing homes. The bill before you seeks to address the problem of elder abuse in a systematic, multifaceted way. And for today's hearing, I'm going to focus on sections in House File 90 that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. First, Article 1, Section 2, starting on line 4.23, governs contracts between assisted living facilities and residents. It establishes a single contract for housing and services, addressing a major point of confusion under today's system. Second, on page 9, line 1, the bill requires that all notices be provided in plain language and that accommodations be made for persons with communication disabilities. Beginning on page 9, line 8, the bill recodifies and strengthens the Bill of Rights for residents in assisted living. Among other things, it requires disclosure that the resident can contract with outside home care providers for services not provided by the assisted living facility and reaffirms the right to file grievances about services received or not received. Turning to page 23, beginning on line 13, we address one of the most common and vexing problems we hear from older and vulnerable adults and their families. Deceptive marketing. Over and over, we have heard that residents have been promised various services or promised that they will be taken care of throughout their aging process, only to be shocked by receiving a termination notice when they actually require the services they've been promised. Finally, being on page 29, line 22, the bill puts some guardrails in place regarding forced arbitration clauses. While banning them is preempted by federal law, among other things, the bill requires disclosure that they are in the contract and prohibit choice of law or venue provisions. And we do have an amendment, but you might want, I think we can open it up to testifiers if you want to do testifiers first.
Representative Schultz, we do have the quorum that we need, so I'm going to take care of a couple pieces of committee business quick. First of all, members, the minutes from March 8th, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Elkins moves approval of the minutes of March 8th, 2019. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Next, we will put House File 90 before us. I will move that House File 90 be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation that it go to State Gov Finance. And I will move the 11-1 author's amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. A motion prevails. Your amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape that you would like, Representative, and happy to hear from testifiers. Ms. George, welcome. You can state your name for the committee and proceed.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. I am here also testifying on behalf of Legal Aid and Elder Voice Family Advocates in support of House File 90. Preventing elder abuse is a top priority for our coalition, and we want to thank Representative Schultz for her leadership on this issue and the opportunity to testify this afternoon. And I'll just speak to the several provisions specific to the committee's jurisdiction. First, as Representative Schultz said, the bill creates a single contract for both housing and home care services, creating one accountable entity for the care of a resident. This addresses a serious problem we have today in that the care is often fragmented when it is delivered by two separate entities. This can cause confusion and undue harm to elderly residents when there is not one responsible party accountable for the development of an individual care plan. So under the bill, residents and family members would now know who to go to regarding care quality concerns, and that the care would be provided in a very coordinated way. These are very important, Madam Chair. The bill also creates a number of disclosure requirements about residents' rights, information about who to call in cases of suspected maltreatment and abuse, and any of the arbitration agreements residents would be required to sign prior to move-in. Additionally, the bill does strengthen rights against retaliation for both residents in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Lastly, the bill prohibits deceptive marketing by assisted living facilities. Unfortunately, we have heard of far too many stories of aggressive sales pitches and misleading tactics used by housing managers to get people to move into these facilities. I want to share with you briefly some stories. We have heard from more than several family members who have told us that the daily wellness checks We're told that the daily wellness checks were part of their service contract, only to find out that the facility did not have a system in place after discovering their parents had died alone and were left for days without anyone checking on them. For residents with Alzheimer's disease, there have been reoccurring problems with deceptive marketing. For Eric Lynn and his mother, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, his experience was nothing short of a nightmare. He was promised quality care from three facilities, but they failed to provide even basic care. They assured him they had security measures, but his mom was able to leave the facility unattended. Eventually, she was discharged with only 24 hours notice and evicted from her home without any assistance from the facility. For Laura Edstrom, her mom, too, was promised quality programming, including being escorted to dinner because she was often confused by the long hallways. But instead, her mother was constantly lost in these hallways, and the programming for residents with dementia consisted of being locked in a room with a television for the whole night. Finally, I just want to share my own perspective on deceptive marketing because our family experienced this too. After my dad's hospitalization, we had transferred him to a nursing home for a short-term stay for rehabilitation. At the time, we were considering moving him to the assisted living that was attached with the nursing home. But after several months, he did recover, and so he wanted to go home, and we were going to get home care for him. So we let the marketing manager know that we were no longer interested in this apartment. Her response surprised us. She said, if your dad doesn't move into this facility against our advice, then Medicare will consider your dad AWOL, and our family would be on the hook for the 100-day nursing home stay. Luckily for me, I knew a thing or two about Medicare rules, but I am very concerned about the many unsuspecting families that may not know and could have been very intimidated by her remarks. So, again, under this bill, these types of marketing practices would be prohibited and enforceable under the law, which is really key. In conclusion, we do believe these provisions will go a long way in protecting vulnerable adults and their families, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. George. Next testifier, I see Carrie Thurlow or Toby Pearson. Welcome. I said or, but we'll make it and.
Madam Chair, we're a tag team.
You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, here also on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. You know, I want to start by acknowledging the stories of harm and abuse that we've heard in the news and with family members throughout this process, and want to acknowledge that they are terrible, they're intolerable. And I think that it's fair to say that in the course of the interim and throughout the fall since the legislature adjourned last year, we've made tremendous progress in coming together as a stakeholder community, providers, consumers, regulators, and payers to further discuss the solutions that are needed to many of the issues. I want to thank Commissioner Malcolm and the Department of Health for doing the hard work over the interim to bring stakeholders together to address these issues. The Long-Term Care Imperative fully participated in those work groups, and we found that, as we long suspected, we have more in common than we separate on these important issues with regard to solutions to the many issues that this legislation attempts to address. As my colleague will say, I get to play good cop here, and then we do still have some concerns with the bill as it continues to move, and know that this is a work in progress as we remain committed to working on these issues. I want to say that the work groups over the fall and the winter identified a set of common principles and emerging areas of consensus that should guide these discussions. And I think it's important to have that touchstone. First, I think there's large agreement that it's important to maintain choice and flexibility in assisted living, recognizing that we start where Minnesota is nationally recognized for promoting choice and flexibility. We have been ranked by groups, including AARP, as number one or number two in the country. It's important to note that these are not institutions, but rather home and community-based services, and we are not seeking here in this legislation to create more nursing homes. The second kind of core principle are that seniors should be able to live as independently as long as they are able, with access to safe, quality care options in the communities that they call home. That is an important element here as well. So on one hand, we're talking about choice, but we are also talking about independence and safety as well. Third, that there are many perspectives that need to be considered as we work together to ensure a system that values that balances the values of independence and choice with the desire for safety and protection. Fourth, whatever law is passed, we need to ensure there are adequate resources for implementation and enforcement. Many of the issues that we have heard have grown out of violations of current regulations, and so any new regulations must also include clear enforcement mechanisms. And fifth, last but not least, prevention should be a key focus of our work. We know that, especially in this committee, we're focused on a few key items and I'm cognizant of that, but we should ensure that there's an infrastructure in place to help use data collected to help inform prevention and quality improvement efforts that should be included in the legislation this year. To be clear, the Long-Term Care Imperative supports assisted living licensure with specific criteria for evaluation, disclosure, and service termination. We support increased dementia care standards. We support language establishing the right to electronic monitoring. We support strengthened protections for consumers against retaliation and deceptive marketing.
We're trying to keep everybody to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're beyond that now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll turn it over to my colleague to specifically address key concerns.
You don't want me to go back to the way I was this morning.
Heard about that.
I'll take your word for it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I was crabby this morning. I apologize to Representative Haley already.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, today with the Long-Term Care Imperative. First, as we have said, we support many of the things that are moving in this assisted living licensure bill, but there are a couple of details that really matter and that we cannot support in its current form. Specific to this particular legislation in this committee, There are overly broad definitions of deceptive marketing and retaliation contained in our opinion. Providers are not opposed to greater protections for either of these issues, but the language appears to be overly broad. For example, with respect to deceptive marketing, it would apply to any misleading statement or representations by any employee. Recollections of verbal interactions are not reliable, which is why written contracts are utilized. Additionally, there are numerous existing state laws for consumer protections from deceptive marketing, including laws prohibiting false advertising and deceptive trade practices. With respect to retaliation, the language would apply to acts against a resident, employee, or person with a familial, personal, legal, or professional relationship with a patient or resident, which is an overly broad universe of folks for that to apply to. Under the language, the provider is presumed guilty of retaliation for any long list of actions taken within 90 days of an initial complaint, and this would include increase in necessary services if the resident's condition changed, the discharge of a resident if their care needs exceeded the provider's ability to administer said care, and would even potentially prevent the termination or discipline of an employee who self-reported a maltreatment incident. The lengthy list of retaliations does not take into account the frequent changes in service needs for senior population served in these settings. Several of the actions considered retaliatory could actually put seniors at greater risk for maltreatment. On the single contract topic, we think that it makes sense to move towards a single contract with one accountable entity. We have concerns with the scope and the enforcement of the Bill of Rights that is currently in this bill. And on forced arbitration clauses, we just want to make sure that there's the availability that if the parties want to enter into a separate arbitration agreement, that would also be allowable. Thank you.
Thank you. And, well, I shouldn't make a comment, but I've never seen a low-income person or a worker win an arbitration. So should be worried about that. Next on the agenda here is, that's it? All right. Any other public testifiers? Anyone else wants to testify about this bill? I'm going to say it one more time, and then we're going to move on. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Good. Member discussion. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, thank you for taking this cause. We know this is a multiple-prong problem, and it's going to need a multifaceted solution to this. And many things were discussed today, and I wish you well with your continued efforts on this. And I know that you don't want to you want what's best in the end on this, and we also have other members of the legislature and people that have parents who are going to be involved in this, or grandparents or other family members. We also want to have the right outcome on this. So I wish you well as you continue on with this, and keep working with the stakeholders, because I think you'll get there. Thank you, Representative.
Any other discussion? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. Having been on Aging and Long-Term Care Committee for several years and being vice chair last year, I'm obviously quite up to date on a lot of the things that are happening. What concerns me, though, is that when we had the Office of Legislative Audit bring back their report, and we're hearing a lot about OHFC and how reports increased, there weren't enough people to take care of it, they didn't have confidence in the folks that were there, and investigation timelines weren't met, things like that. My question is, what does your bill do to make sure that OHFC is held a little bit more in check, and in fact that they are doing their job?
Representative Schultz.
I think the agency might want to respond to that, or Ron. Here we go. Yes.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Marie Dotseth, and I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And Representative, you ask a good question about what we've been doing, and I think we are happy to provide you with updates in terms of our investigative timelines and data. We publish a public dashboard now that shows all of the information on the number of reports that are coming in and the number that we close. We were publishing information on the number of substantiated reports, and we put that up weekly on our dashboard. So there's a number of things that we're doing, and I think when Commissioner Malcolm has come and presented to either the House or the Senate, she mentions that we still have a long way to go. We've implemented a number of improvements and have published a number of data to put out there to the public, but we know we still have a long way to go in some of those improvements. And we are happy to come anytime you would like us to come and present you with updates on all of those OLA findings.
Representative Faith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who wants to take this, but what I'm asking is there anything in this bill that addresses those concerns and those findings?
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative, there are a number of items in the governor's budget that do address this. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for reminding me. There are several parts of the governor's budget that address those findings directly.
And
okay,
Representative
Pace. I guess I'm hearing, no, there isn't. We're relying on the governor to do this, and I'm really concerned because that was a large part of what was happening is the OHFC was not doing their job, and yet we're looking at pointing fingers at just about everybody else but the agency, and I just want to make sure that we do have some safeguards in place to make sure that the agency knows that they are largely responsible for what happened, and what are we doing to make sure that it doesn't happen again? When I see things like there was no confidence in leadership and such, that's really discouraging. And we can make all the laws we want, but if we don't look at the agency where basically the buck should stop here, I'm not sure that doing a lot of other good stuff is going to cover up what really needs to happen. And those are my concerns with the bill. I don't feel like we're addressing where the problem lied, and we're looking at some other means to take care of things. I really hope we can address those concerns as we go on, but I don't see us doing those things right now. Thank you.
Hi, can I ask a question before you respond, or would you like to respond first?
Go ahead.
Has the agency had, over the 4 or 5 or 6 years that this built up, how many times did the agency just say, oh, we don't need another staff person, we'll just absorb that cost? I guess my question is, did you have the staff to do this kind of inspections of long-term care facilities?
Mr. Chair, I think what we realized happened over time is that the volume of complaints increased very rapidly. And so, I mean, there were a number of factors that led to that coming together all at one time. And, you know, as things changed, as the aging population grew, as the MARC reporting system made it easier for reports to come in, we found ourselves falling behind. And we did a number of things over the past several years to make sure that that's not happening anymore.
And did you ask for the staff at the time?
I've only been at the agency for a little over a year. I understand, yes, we have asked for some, and
no, I meant at the time that you realized, did you ask for the staff? And if you weren't there, unless you could bring somebody forward who was, that's fine. Representative Schultz, you wanted to respond.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to require more than just this one bill, piece of legislation. The agency had to act. They could not wait for legislation, so they had to act quickly to resolve those issues, to process claims and investigate, so they did. And we've had Commissioner Malcolm at the Long-Term Care Division multiple times to talk about these issues. So that committee, I think, has felt that they've been informed about how that process was handled and how everything has been rectified in terms of slow processes of claims and follow-up and investigation. But this bill is, we need to pass this legislation to give more power to have more oversight and regulation to prevent these types of abuses from ever happening. So I think this is one of the key pieces of legislation we need, but also to fund the agencies and the office, the Ombudsman's Office for Long-Term Care, so they can also help. And that's a separate bill as well, as to fund the Ombudsman's Office for Long-Term Care, so we can be more active with people on the ground to follow up with investigations and file reports and provide education and information to family members.
Members, is there any other discussion to this? We have one person that wants to testify. I just realized this is a Commerce Committee, and it seemed like we were getting a little off there. So if I could ask staff to kind of what pieces of this bill should the Commerce Committee to address?
Mr. Chair and members, we're focusing primarily on Article 1 issues involving deceptive marketing practices, contract requirements, and disclosure requirements.
Thank you. If you'd like to testify, ma'am. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Hi, my name is Sheila Van Pelt, and my questions don't pertain exactly to those, but they were in direct response to your questions and to Representative Keels. So from there, I can address
I think neither of those were in the preview of the Commerce Committee. So thank you
so much.
Any other discussion or questions for the author? I don't know who made the first motion, but I'm seeing no other discussion. I'm going to renew the motion to re-refer House File 90 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation to be referred to State Government Finance Division. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? I think you're on your way.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Next on the agenda, House File 1340, Representative Lean. All right. Going once, going twice. You don't see the guy. Edelson? We're going to go to Edelson. House File 766. You can go two times. Welcome to the committee. I will move House File 766. To be referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation to be referred to House File HHS Finance. Did I say that right? All right. Welcome to Commerce.
Thank you, Chair. Hello, members. I will keep this brief. This is an expansion of medical marijuana in the state of Minnesota. I will draw your attention to three areas of the bill. 4.16 through 4.20 deals with specifically with adding dispensaries to the state. There's currently 8 allowable. This would allow for one additional one per congressional district to be added. And that's 4.16 to 4.20. The second area would be 6.4 to 6.7. Manufacturers will be able to sell products to the other manufacturer. So we have MinMed and Leafline for the two manufacturers. Both, just so you know, members, that we do have representatives from both of those organizations for today. And then the other one, and I have it on my amendment, and I'm not sure where it would be in members. It was added as an amendment in the last committee, but the third piece that we're adding is the sale of industrial hemp to manufacturers that I believe would be in the purview of this committee. Those would be the three areas. And I'm happy to take questions.
If all those amendments had been adopted in the last bill, I think we have public testimony. Do you have a testifier or two? Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brandon Borges, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. I'm the board chair of Sensible Change Minnesota. We are the policy arm of Sensible Minnesota. We've been helping patients with the medical cannabis bill since its inception in 2014. We've worked with over 500 patients and host a patient group of around 700 patients, and have also successfully commissioned the Commissioner of Health for the addition of traumatic stress disorder, autism spectrum disorder, and Alzheimer's disease. So first off, I would really like to thank Representative Edelson and all her hard work in making this step forward. We do believe that this will be a step to bring patients more affordable medicine. Medical cannabis is hard to access. It's also very difficult to afford for our patients. We have low patient numbers in Minnesota, and products that sometimes cost up to four times the equivalent in other states. As of last Friday, there were 15,000 some patients enrolled in the program. In comparison, New York and Pennsylvania, who have adopted our model, have around 100,000 patients each. Adjusted for population, that puts them at nearly 30 and 40,000 respectively. Patient access model like Arizona, for example, serves around 150,000 patients, so the equivalent. In addition, some of these other problems that we've been seeing coming up is that over 7,000 of these patients have dropped their enrollment due to costs and other reasons. According to the January Medical Cannabis Program update from the Office of Medical Cannabis, fewer than 11,000 of these patients enrolled have actually made a purchase from the registered state manufacturers. So while our medical cannabis program ranks as a C- through Americans for Safe Access, this is a national watchdog group for medical cannabis program, that ranks actually slowly getting better in Minnesota, and we believe that this is a step in the right direction. Giving manufacturers the ability to wholesale their products to each other will get patients options to be able to purchase different medicines from the two manufacturers. Currently, we have patients going to between both of them. As well as the addition of new patient centers, we have patients that drive 4 or 5 hours one way to get a 30-day supply. It's very difficult for them. As the last piece of this, we are concerned about would be the addition of these new patient centers and maybe the overhead costs being passed on to patients. But we do hope that by allowing the manufacturers to purchase hemp products and CBD from local Minnesota farmers, that may offset that cost. So don't get me wrong, members of the committee, we have a long way to go, but this bill is a step in the right direction for our patients. So we're committed to working with all of you, and we want to improve access and affordability for patients that are not served by our program currently. So thank you for your time, and thank you again, Representative Edelson.
Thank you. Members, I'm informed that this is not the correct engrossment of this particular bill.
I was going to say, I don't think it is.
We're having them printed at the present time, and they'll be here as soon as they're done. So, do you have any other
No, Chair, I do not. I was just going to walk through and just let you know in terms of the dispensaries. I think that it will be about patient access, the second piece about addressing the manufacturers being able to sell to one another. I think will help with innovation of, there are two different companies that are...
Why don't you wait a minute?
Oh, yeah.
I think we have another testifier. And
oh, is there? Okay.
Doing your closing remarks, it's best to do them after the testifiers. Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Paul Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Campaign for Full Legalization. I come forward before you today to talk about some of the money issues with this program. And I just want to bring the Pioneer Press from this weekend, and I hope you all saw it. We've been saying for 5 years this program is not working. People cannot financially afford it. It's an access issue. The patients have been asking for years to address this. There is enough activity happening in the state of Minnesota that we have the Minnesota Workers' Comp Program paying for the medical cannabis program for their patients, but people that are seen through Health and Human Services programs can't receive those funds. We've been hearing the patients on the price of this product that it will come down if we can get more patients involved in the program. Through the SSI program, the federal program, there's over 98,000 Minnesotans that are involved with that. Just by pure definition of being in that program, they qualify for the use of medical cannabis under Minnesota statute, but none of them None of them can afford it. I don't agree with the appropriations going to dispensaries and manufacturings to say that that's going to make patient access. There's been no money put into patient access for us to get our medicine. If this was insulin, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. It would have been done 4 years ago. So I am asking everybody to step up and say, no, we need to address these issues because these are real issues, and it's going to continue to get in the way of the problem of this program. And we are spending far too much money for ancillary services and not addressing the reason why this program started, and that was to address the sickest of the sick. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Any other persons that care to speak to this particular bill? I'm going to move to discussion. Everybody keeps pointing to you. I'm going to get to you, but I'm trying to. Okay, everybody, just point at Dean. Representative Dean. Be careful with your finger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be for either the author or the testifier. We know that the number of patients is pretty low in Minnesota, and I'm wondering if the bill or if part of the issue is physicians licensing individuals for medical cannabis, because I know that when we first started the program, that was a real concern that not too many physicians were actually engaged in the process of licensing individuals for medical cannabis use, and I'm curious if that's changed over the past few years. If you could address that, that would be great.
Sorry, I'm going to phone up one of my people here.
Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Parker. I'm the CEO of Leafline, one of the two manufacturers. To your question, Representative, we're not seeing a shortage of qualifying physicians to certify patients. I think the last number I saw was around 1,500 are currently registered.
Representative.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So 1,500 physicians registered, then creating 15,000 people in the state of Minnesota, while other states have over 100,000. So I'm curious if it's an issue of numbers of people in the state. I mean, there seems to be a number sort of differentiation that doesn't seem to make sense right now. And I'm curious if people are trying to dig into that as well, because it seems to be, you know, the numbers don't seem to make sense.
Chair. When this program, freshman rep coming into this, when this program was created in 2014, it was created as one of the most restrictive programs in the United States. And so what I think in terms of, I apologize, I didn't get your name, but when he came up to testify about the cost, it is a burden. The cost is one of the largest things that I've heard about when taking up this bill. This bill does go to chip away at that. Now, it's not going to move the needle enough, but we don't know. I do think that the cost is prohibitive for many people. Having medical marijuana in the state of Minnesota, honestly, is a privilege. Insurance does not cover it. I think that we're about 11,000 people in the state of Minnesota are using, which other states that don't have such a restrictive program have many more participants. So I would like to go into that more, and I think we're going to revisit and see how the things in this bill actually do for cost. I mean, one of the things that's not in my bill, but both of these companies were not allowed to deduct their business expenses. In terms of also appropriations were addressed, the only appropriation that's happening on this bill is to the Office of Medical Marijuana, which is going to help with patient calls and things like that. So there's no other appropriation that's happening on this bill, and that's collected from fees that people pay. So hopefully that answers some of your question, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, it answers some of my questions, and I know that when we instituted it, it was the most restrictive in the state, but over the past several years, Department of Health has begun to expand what are the medical conditions in which it can be used. So I'm assuming that the number of people that have the opportunity to be registered for medical cannabis has increased greatly. And the question is, are they not? I like what your bill does, don't get me wrong, but I think there's a larger issue, and I'll just leave it at that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just have a procedural question, and you can take it whenever you want. It just has to do with maybe getting the proper engrossment copied into the committee. Is that our plan? Okay, that's all I was looking for. Thank you.
Representative David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be remiss if I didn't clarify something here that needs to be said. And I do this in every committee every time that a person says this. We just had a member of this legislature say, in effect, well, it's because I'm a freshman. You're a member of the legislature. That's the way it is. So you don't have to say that because we can tell. It's quite obvious. So please don't say that. You are a member of this House. Act like it.
This from the member that one time told me he wasn't going to remember my name until I won my second election.
Mr. Chairman, I'm of the opinion that freshmen will be seen and not heard.
Mr. Chair, I definitely am heard. So,
thank you, Representative Davids. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Is there any other discussion? We are going to wait on the engrossment, and then we are going to move back. Yeah, this our copy machine seems to be running a little slow. I'm going to lay this bill over. You'll have to sit here for a little while longer. Representative Lean. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Representative Lean. Let's see, which bill is this one right here? I'll move your bill for you. I'm going to move House File 90 as 1340 for re-referral to the Health and Human Services Policy Do you have an amendment for this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I appreciate you hearing this bill today, House File 1340. And just a little bit of a background on this bill. The first mental health and substance use disorder parity bill was passed in 96, and a second bill was passed in 2008, which substantially strengthened the mental health parity standards. The regulations went into effect on January 13, 2014. Mental health parity has consistently been a bipartisan issue, with Congressman Ramstead and Senator Wellstone, both serving as key advocates at the federal level. The law and accompanying federal regulations require health plans to cover mental health and substance use disorders as they do for physical health care if the plan covers mental health or substance use disorder treatment. Minnesota law incorporates the federal mental health parity requirements. There are three components of the mental health and substance use disorder parity law: out-of-pocket costs, arbitrary treatment limits, and non-quantitative treatment limits. Health plans cannot have higher out-of-pocket costs for mental health care or substance use disorder than other forms of health care. This means that, with a few exceptions, copays for mental health care or substance use disorder cannot be higher than for physical health care, and there cannot be different deductibles or out-of-pocket maximums for mental health care and substance use disorder. Health plans cannot set arbitrary treatment limits for mental health care. For example, a health plan cannot offer unlimited primary care appointments, but only three mental health therapy appointments. non-quantitative treatment limits are tools a health plan uses to manage their benefit set. Mental health parity stipulates that the standards that a health plan uses to determine the benefits for mental health and substance use disorder treatment cannot be any more stringent or restrictive than it is for other categories of health care. For example, many plans cover rehab in a nursing home after hip replacement, but would not cover rehab in an intensive residential treatment program, or an IRTS, for someone with a serious mental illness leaving the hospital. This would be a mental health parity violation. Other examples of mental health parity violations through the use of NQTLs, which again are non-quantitative treatment limits, include narrower networks for mental health and substance use disorder, using a more stringent process to approve new treatments for mental health or substance use disorder, or more restrictive use of prior authorization requirements to obtain treatment. To ensure compliance with federal parity regulations, health plans must already document the strategies and processes that led to the determination of a NQTL for both mental health and other forms of health treatment. Now, there are grave consequences for patients and families for failing to meet the mental health parity. Some of these include unique burdens, such as having to call to get permission for mental health care, but not other types of care, restrictive drug formularies that make it harder to access necessary medications, higher copays, deductibles, and coinsurance rates that deter accessing mental health treatment, denials of care due to an arbitrary standard of what is deemed medical necessity, limiting in-network mental health providers, making it more difficult to receive care, and lack of coverage for residential treatment or intensive home care. If current mental health parity laws are enforced, more Minnesotans will be able to access the mental health and substance use disorder treatment they need, and the outcomes will be more positive in the long run. In late 2017, NAMI National released its third nationwide parity report called Doctor Is Out. The report found that despite the federal parity law, people lack the same access to mental health providers as they have for other medical providers. For example, 34% with private insurance had difficulty finding a mental health therapist, compared to only 13% reporting difficulty finding a medical specialist. And when people did find a mental health provider, many were forced to go out of network and, by extension, pay higher out-of-pocket costs. This happened at much higher rates than when seeking primary or even specialty medical care. 28% receiving mental health therapy used an out-of-network therapist, compared to only 7% needing to use out-of-network medical specialists. A report from Milliman that same year also found higher use of out-of-network providers for mental health and substance use disorder treatment, and a pattern of stark differences in payment rates for mental health providers across 50 states, 3 years, and 42 million lives. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I can speak to the amendment. The A19-0126 author's amendment would change the title of the bill and delete Section 1 and 2 of the bill, which eliminates redundant language in consideration of existing federal law and the language in Section 3 of the bill for NQTLs, which again are non-quantitative treatment limits. The amendment also changes Section 4 of the bill as follows. It allows the Commissioner of Commerce to require data from health plans that mental health parity is being followed. It ensures that mental health care is considered primary care for the purposes of patient cost-sharing requirements, and requires the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with the Commissioner of Health, to report to the legislature annually beginning January 1, 2021 on state enforcement of mental health parity laws rather than mandating this reporting from the health plans. We can now take up the amendment, Mr. Chair, if you like.
I try to lean towards the author, so if you're ready to get the bill in the order that you would like it with your amendment.
Yes.
Do you only have one?
I only have one, yes.
Okay. And that would be the 0126?
0126, yes, Mr. Chair.
I don't have to worry about that one, do I? No. All right, let me get rid of it. I will move the A19-0126. And you've explained that particular amendment. Are there any questions on the amendment? Any questions on the amendment? Any testimony to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A19 amendment, the author's amendment? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is in the way that you like.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. And now to speak to the bill, despite federal and state law, mental health parity is still not being enforced because we rely on consumer complaints to identify parity violations. No one in the midst of a mental health crisis thinks to call the Department of Commerce or the U.S. Department of Labor. We need to strengthen the ability of the Departments of Health and Commerce to enforce current law. And just to speak to the bill here, it defines NQTLs, which again are non-quantitative treatment limits, mirroring the definition in federal law and federal regulations. States that a health plan may not impose an NQTL with respect to mental health or substance use disorder treatment if the processes for determining this NQTL are more restrictive or stringent than those applied to medical or surgical benefits. It provides more accountability by giving the Department of Commerce and Health the authority to request the information from health plans to confirm that mental health parity is being fully implemented. This includes any data on the use of NQTLs like prior authorizations, network adequacy, provider credentialing and reimbursement, medical necessity, adoption of coverage for new treatments, wait times, drug formularies, out-of-pocket costs, claim denials, in-home services, rehabilitative services, and other data that may indicate a parity violation. It requires therapy visits and medication maintenance be considered primary care for the purposes of copays and deductibles that a plan enrollee must pay. It requires the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health to monitor the implementation of mental health parity to ensure that health care plans are following mental health parity requirements. This can include market conduct examinations, and it requires an annual report by the Commissioner of Commerce to the legislature every year regarding their efforts to enforce parity law, including any enforcement actions taken. Again, increasing transparency and creating new enforcement mechanisms will lead to better and more long-term health care for Minnesotans and more equitable health care for all Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, committee members, at this time I can stand for questions or we can allow testifiers to make comments.
Why don't we go to your testifiers, and then we'll, if anyone cares to speak for or against the bill and from the public, we'll bring them down also. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. You know, we finally began to understand that our head is connected to the rest of our body and that good mental health is essential to overall health. One in five people will develop a mental illness during their lifetime, and that's a significant portion of the population. And yet a significant portion cannot obtain the treatment they need to get better. Parity doesn't even require coverage of mental health and substance use disorder. It just says if you do, then you need to treat it the same way. So you have to cover illnesses of the brain, such as depression or addiction, no more restrictively than illnesses of the body, such as diabetes. And parity really, I mean, all it really is about is, again, treating mental illness as any other healthcare condition. So the process that you use to determine new medications or treatments should be covered the same way. The drug formulary shouldn't be more restrictive. The in-network list of providers shouldn't be more limited. Plans shouldn't review mental health treatment more frequently to determine medical necessity. Plans shouldn't have more restrictive criteria to determine what is medically necessary. And this federal law incorporated into Minnesota law provided us with hope, hope that we or our loved ones would have coverage for the treatment needed to recover. But I can tell you that the promise of parity has not been realized. My own family was impacted when our health plan wouldn't pay for the emergency room visit or the ambulance because it was a suicide attempt. There was a lesser percentage paid for the hospital bill and a very limited number of therapy visits. To say that my health plan discriminated against covering mental health treatment is an understatement. Many families like mine go into deep debt to pay for the care our loved ones need. Let me assure you, there are no bake sales or GoFundMe pages for mental health care. It's emptying our savings, charging treatment on credit cards, delaying retirement, and more. And it's not fair. We have a crisis in our state with an increasing number of people dying by suicide, and an increasing number of people dying by opioid overdoses, and an increase in the prevalence of mental illness in children. If private insurance does not come to the table and follow the parity law, we will not stem these crises, and it will continue to get worse. Enforcing parity will save lives and state funding. Right now, when parity isn't enforced, people sign up for Medicaid. It's a cost shift. And the care is more expensive because care is delayed and denied until it reaches a crisis. Have you tried to see a psychiatrist or therapist, get into a hospital or residential treatment? You get to wait. And it's not just because there's a shortage of providers. It's because of narrow networks and low payment rates. There are providers wanting to be accepted into these networks because they know there are waiting lists, and the waiting lists are long, and told we're good, we have enough providers. Around the country, states and national organizations are looking at best practices for parity enforcement. All agree that prospective compliance verifications are necessary as long as there's also a retrospective review following a consumer complaint. We need to ensure ahead of time that plans are in fact following the law, and they need to provide information to verify that they are following the law. Now, the plans will tell you there have been few complaints, but again, when you're in the midst of a mental health crisis and the treatment your loved one needs won't be covered by insurance, you don't stop and think, I'll call the Department of Commerce, said no one ever. You shouldn't have to rely on complaints for enforcement. The department should review the plans ahead of time to make sure they're following the law. Last year, we agreed again for the second time to a task force to figure out how the plans would submit data. I want to say that initially it was a much greater analysis that was worked on by the National Parity Coalition that some states have adopted. So it was a huge spreadsheet that they would have to do and quite complicated. And we tried actually over two summers to say, well, what information could you provide? And we didn't get anything. And I'm going to be honest. We've waited a decade for enforcement, a decade, and we're not ready to wait any longer. The plans tell us that they are following parity. This means that they did their own analysis. We'll show the department that analysis. The data we placed in the bill instead of the huge analysis is data that they have, and it's data that will help the departments know if, in fact, they are following parity and treating mental health and substance use disorders the same as other health care conditions. Please provide the tools to the department to enforce existing law. Don't place the burden on people struggling with their mental illnesses or on families stretched to the max as they try to navigate the mental health system and the complexity of health plans. Our state got an F for parity enforcement, an F. We're not asking for new mandates. We're not asking for new coverage. All we're asking for is fairness. We just want the current law enforced. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I suspect you have another testifier, and it's my regret or my failure is to have kept you to 2 minutes, so I'm going to try to keep you to 2 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Christensen. I've lived in Lakeville for 16 years. I'm here today to speak about my son, Drew. Drew was diagnosed with bipolar 2 in the summer of 2014 after he had completed his third year of studies in chemistry at the University of Minnesota. He took his lithium because it was element number 3 on the periodic table. He was studying to be a chemist. He understood what it did. But over time, his swings became more pronounced, making it a struggle for him to perform in his classes. He did finally receive his diploma after completing his studies in the spring of 2016, and soon after that, he landed a job as a contractor at 3M. In 2015, my wife Nancy and I attended a NAMI family-to-family course on mental illness. We learned a great deal about diagnoses and treatments, and we also learned about a community mental health organization in St. Paul called Guild Incorporated. I remember telling Nancy that I wish I had known about Guild when Drew was first diagnosed, because they offered care coordination, which assesses the kind of care someone needs and how to help them, and they had a range of services, including residential treatment. My wife and I longed for Drew to agree to therapy in addition to his meds and quarterly visits to the psychiatrist. He resisted, and there was no way that we could force this athletic and sometimes hot-tempered young man to go. His job at 3M lasted only a couple of months due to an outburst with his supervisor. I had hoped this would be the natural consequence that would persuade Drew to seek counseling, but he landed an even better job right away, assisting with research at Ecolab. He was a contractor again, but this time, this was a dream job with a path to full-time position. We don't know for sure, but we suspect that Drew stopped taking his meds once he landed his position at Ecolab. He was living at home with us during the summer of 2016, and his behavior became more erratic. He was using alcohol and marijuana to self-medicate. He got a DUI in early August and became threatening. Nancy and I had already been meeting with a social worker from Guild on a private pay basis because we needed someone to help us make a plan. We didn't know how to navigate the system to get the help that Drew needed. On September 11th, Drew became threatening again, and we asked the Lakeville police to help us. He was taken by ambulance to HCMC, where he spent about 10 days. We had insurance through my wife's company, and it paid the majority of Drew's hospitalization and about 50% of the $5,000 ambulance ride to the hospital. After his discharge, he returned home and discovered that he had lost his dream job. About a week later, he was hospitalized again, and this time was prescribed an additional medication to help suppress psychotic episodes. We knew he needed more services, maybe even residential, but it didn't appear that our insurance covered any of these things other than meds, hospitalization, and therapy, and he needed more. We went to the county to see what services we could get there. I took him to his psychiatry appointment, but the psychiatrist wasn't there that day. Apparently, they had tried to leave a message on Drew's cell phone, but he hadn't set up his voicemail yet before he had gone into the hospital. I took Drew to his first meeting with his therapist, and Drew said that he knew more than the therapist. I took him to intake meetings at the county, and he started becoming discouraged again because of all the consent forms. He was a 25-year-old living at home with his parents, and these were all triggers that he didn't know how to handle. We had found an attorney who helped Drew get past his DUI, and he even got a provisional driver's license so that he could work catering jobs while trying to find another job in chemistry. He was discouraged because he recognized that he had a lot of work to do to reconcile relationships and pay people back for the expenses they had covered for him following his manic episodes. I often worked from home during this time, and we would go for walks, and that would help ease his anxiety. On Monday, November 7th, I reached out to the social worker at the county because I hadn't heard from her about next steps. She got back to me on the morning of November 8th to let me know that they were still trying to figure out whether Drew might qualify for Social Security disability or Medicaid. Medicaid would have covered the additional services he needed. That afternoon, we received a call from the Lakeville police. They told us that the Minneapolis police confirmed that our son had died that morning. He had climbed the railing on a bridge. Someone stopped to ask if he was okay. He said no and then stepped to his death. I honestly don't know what services our son might have benefited from. But I know with certainty that he needed more. My wife and I didn't know how to help him, and we desperately needed someone who could act as a quarterback so that we could return to being parents. When a loved one is diagnosed with a mental illness, you don't know what questions to ask. And yet, you somehow need to develop the expertise to know how to work the system to your loved one's advantage. And then there's HIPAA, a formidable defensive line meant to protect your loved one, except that it's really a roadblock at every turn. If someone has a cancer diagnosis, they typically don't put up a fuss about signing consent forms. But when someone is battling the unpredictability of bipolar, it's a lot harder to gain their consent just so that you can help them get the help that they need. I believe that my son could be alive today if the intensity of services provided by Guild had been available to us under our private insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. I and all of us are sorry for your loss. Is there another testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Jay, and I am the mother of Carter Schmidt. Carter's a brilliant, compassionate, funny 16-year-old that has lived with a mental illness since he was 7. The symptoms began with Carter pulling out 6 of his teeth that were not loose. He picked at his skin so much that the wounds wouldn't heal for months. We sought therapy for him, which began our journey into the mental health system. Over the years, all of his symptoms have escalated because he has not responded to outpatient treatment. And more often than not, he refuses to participate. Many times on the way to treatment, he jumped out of my moving car trying to escape the anxiety of going to therapy. In 6th grade, he had his first suicide attempt and his first hospitalization, which started the cycle we have been on in the years since. Ambulance, hospital, partial hospitalization, and which usually is cut off by the insurance company after 8 to 20 days, and then outpatient treatment, which he refuses. We have been on this cycle for years because Carter refuses outpatient treatment and the insurance company does not want to pay for the level of care that he needs. In November, Carter had a knife and was planning to use it to hurt himself. I was able to get the knife away from him, and while I was on the phone with the 911 operator, Carter removed the screen from our second-story bedroom window and was headfirst out the window trying to jump. I caught him in time. I had to hold his hoodie sweatshirt and the belt loop of his pants to keep him from jumping headfirst out of our window. Carter was sent to the hospital in an ambulance. Per usual, there weren't any adolescent beds in the entire state of Minnesota. So he stayed in the emergency room in a locked concrete room with a bed and a television from Friday until Tuesday. No programming, no therapy. The hospital asked us several times if we just wanted to discharge him because there were no beds available. On Tuesday, he was moved to another hospital and was able to get treatment for 8 days in the hospital before the insurance company decided it was no longer medically necessary. He was stepped down to a partial hospitalization program, and I was very worried it was not a high enough level of care to keep him safe. Over the course of that month, he ran away from the treatment program several times. The last time, the Edina police had to be called to help find him. The police needed to be called several times in our home because he could not regulate his emotions and he was destructive to property. It was determined that he needed a higher level of care and residential treatment was recommended. We found a program that was a locked facility and is typically a 3 to 6 month program focused on DBT skills and emotional regulation. With his history of running and refusing treatment, this was the best option for his care. I knew that Carter would refuse this option, so I planned a secured car to be at my home the morning of January 1st to drive him to the residential treatment program because I did not believe I could get him there safe with a history of jumping out of the car. Once Carter learned where he was going, he ran from home without a coat, and it was below zero. We had 5 police cars searching for Carter, and we were eventually able to get him into the secured car and admitted into residential treatment. We had several weeks of Carter not responding to treatment and his symptoms were worsening. On January 23rd in family therapy, he told us he was thinking about suicide all the time and he planned to pretend to be fine, but as soon as he was discharged, he planned to kill himself. He was put on 15-minute checks for the next week to make sure he was safe. A few days later, Carter started removing screws in his windows in his bedroom and started talking about escaping the locked facility. Thank you. The 15-minute checks were extended for one more week. Upon learning about the extension, Carter threw his chair at a locked door and began throwing his body at the door to try and break it so he could escape. January 31st, the day after this incident, Carter finally accepted that he was there and began responding to treatment. He told us he knew he needed to be there and he wanted to learn the skills so that he never had to go to a hospital again. He participated in school and therapy and began learning the DBT skills that they were teaching. February 7th, the day after his 2 weeks of 15-minute checks ended, 7 days after he started responding to treatment, we learned the insurance company was doing a review of his treatment and had only approved 4 more days. He was no longer in crisis, and they were questioning whether the treatment was medically necessary. I called the patient advocate that works for the insurance company and pleaded with her to have her help us.
We finally had a breakthrough, and we needed him to be able to complete his program. I told her I feared for his safety, and I did not believe I could keep him safe if he was sent home. February 15th, we learned that he was no longer covered by insurance, and we needed to come pick him up. It was Friday and President's Day weekend. We did not have any services set up for his aftercare. His father and I decided to private pay for the weekend in the hope of setting up services for Carter when he got home. The insurance company denied our appeal. He was discharged on Tuesday with nothing in place. We are currently 3 weeks out from discharge, and Carter still does not have any aftercare services in place. We keep getting referrals to places that are either not covered by your insurance, have long waiting lists, can't take him because he's too acute, or would require him to be in a regular classroom. Since his discharge, Carter has run away from home twice. The first time, it was in the middle of a blizzard, and he was wearing shorts and no coat. I followed him down the street in my slippers, also without a coat, while I was on the phone with 911. He ran away again on Sunday, no coat. We are frustrated because he was finally responding to treatment for the first time in 9 years. He was on phase two of a four-phase program. He went from a locked facility with 24/7 staff to our home with no services. He needs a higher level of care, and we are unable to get it to him due to our insurance. We are terrified for his safety. Please support enforcing the parity laws. No family should have to go through what we are going through. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Paul Goering. I'm here today as a past president for the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, representing the almost 500 practicing psychiatrists in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 1340. Both my background as a practicing psychiatrist of 27 years and in my role leading the mental health and addiction service line of Allina Health have informed my passion for the parity issue. Over 10 years ago, the federal government passed a critical piece of legislation in the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, which requires equity in insurance coverage of mental health and substance use disorder care. However, years later, mental health parity is still not a reality. According to the National Milliman Report, and confirmed by many subsequent studies, access to care in Minnesota is not measuring up. This bill requires transparency and accountability on the part of insurers. This is necessary because numerous investigations have found that insurers are frequently out of compliance with the federal parity law's requirement that relate to non-quantitative treatment limits. These include practices such as prior authorization, step care, reimbursement rate setting, and provider network design, to name a few. Virtually every investigation has found problems in these areas. According to Milliman, there are unequal reimbursement rates for psychiatric payment practices. They're 40 to 59% lower for psychiatrists, and this is one of the highest rate disparities in the nation. Comparable services provided in primary care and psychiatry would yield $100 in primary care and $41 to $60 in psychiatry. These long-time funding discrepancies have underfunded our mental health and substance use treatment system and squeezed resources for our patients. Long wait times for initial clinic appointments and gaps in service openings happen all the time, and none of these challenges are new. Imagine similar gaps leading to a wait time of 2 or perhaps 4 weeks for in-network service if you had a kidney stone, or sitting in a hospital bed after a heart attack waiting 2 weeks for a post-acute rehab bed. In medical circumstances, there would be outrage and action. The Minnesota Psychiatric Society strongly supports mandated annual reporting by health plans to our regulating state agencies. Despite federal and state laws, mental health parity is still not being enforced. Information is the first step in starting to address this issue and into achieving better partnership between the state, payers, and providers. We don't have transparent data that tells us how far out of the line we are today. HF 1340 is a critical step in figuring that out so we can correct it for the benefit of those we serve. I want to thank Representative Ween for authoring this important legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Matthew Schaefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm the Government Relations Director for Medica, and today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I can empathize with what the other testifiers are going through. About 6 months before the mental health parity law went into effect, I had the privilege of writing a eulogy for a loved one as well. And frankly, it was the mental illness that took him away from us, and there's a relative that got to find the body, and, you know, that's not a fun place to be. Having said that, as we look at the bill in front of us, I want to begin by thanking Representative Lane and NAMI Minnesota for the amendment they brought forward. We believe it's a step in the right direction, and though we still would recommend going with a work group model for carrying out the intent of the bill. To give a little context on the type of coverage or how the law is implemented right now, every health plan in the state of Minnesota is required by law to submit a any health insurance products that we wish to offer in Minnesota, as well as the Departments of Commerce and or Health for review and approval. And through that process, each health plan must sign an attestation that we are offering products that treat medical expenses for a mental illness in the same manner which we would treat a medical or surgical procedure. In addition to that, we're in regular contact with regulators on a number of matters that with respect to health insurance, to include ensuring that we're paying our members' medical bills, whether they're being treated for diabetes or depression. In addition, regulatory authorities have the authority to audit carriers to ensure we're operating in compliance with state and federal laws, and they do use that authority. The recommendation we would go for, though, is in addition to that, we're also waiting for guidance from federal regulators as well in terms of how we should respond to different requests for information. That's a rulemaking process that's still in effect, particularly with how the disclosure laws with ERISA interact with the mental health parity law regulations. That's something that we're hoping we'll get some new guidance on that. In addition, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC, is currently in the process of conducting its work on market conduct examinations for mental health parity, which means we're in the process of figuring out what they're looking for as regulators, and they're in the process of looking at our products and making sure that we're operating in compliance with the law. Instead of setting up a new set of reporting requirements, we would recommend going with a work group format, and one of the reasons for which is for the other states that have already passed this law. In the implementation phase, they've already figured out that they need a work group to figure out how they're going to put together this information in a way that is going to help patients and consumers. So with that, that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for the witnesses? Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lean? Representative Lean, you offered to answer any questions. Are there any questions from the members? Any questions from the members? Representative Davids, you have an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the H1340A1 amendment.
Would you care to explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this amendment does is this goes to what the health plans had talked about, what they would prefer. The bill, the way it is not supported by the health plans. In last year's omnibus bill that was vetoed by the governor, we had agreed to language between the mental health advocates and the plans to set up a working group to move this forward. As the testifier said, this really needs to be done. Now, if the lien bill passes, these are the reporting requirements right here. Now, how does this help anybody that needs mental health crisis care? I don't know. This is what they have to do. Instead of giving care, they got to be filling out papers. Okay, this is just wrong. This is a very one-sided approach. It's heavy-handed. There's no buy-in. You have to have buy-in. We have to have a working group to put this together so you can come. I'll tell you what. You have a working group put this together. You come to the legislature, and I would guess that there would be zero no votes. I think it would pass through 100%. Without my amendment, this bill is going nowhere this year. I mean, that's quite obvious. And so do you want something that passes, that gets the two sides together talking, or do you want to have another feel-good meeting and think you're doing something when you're not? Because that's what's going on.
Are you planning your bill, your amendment?
Yes, yes, that's what my amendment does. Okay, so it puts a working group together. We don't use a sledgehammer like this bill does. The plans to the amendment, that, well, first of all, this bill is not balanced as it is. It's not balanced. It's one-sided. It's heavy-handed. The plans already submit information to Commerce on their filings and need to attest to parity in their DHS contracts. They're already doing it. I think we've seen that the real problem here is the Department of Commerce. We have the laws. We can pass all the laws we want. We can put more laws on the books, and they're not enforcing it. Kelly J. said, please support enforcing the parity laws. Amen. I agree. Dr. Gearing said, mental health parity still not being enforced. The laws are on the books. They're there. Throwing another law, a heavy-handed law making the health plans go through all this, doesn't help a thing. It doesn't help a thing. The law's already there. I think we need to talk to the Department of Commerce and say, why aren't you enforcing the laws that are already there? That's my question. Is the laws are there, why aren't they being enforced? That's my question.
Did you want me to bring down the Department of Commerce to answer that particular question?
Yes, yes.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the original bill required that type of reporting, not as amended.
Why don't we wait till we get this question, and then if we'd like to speak.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwood, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Representative Davids, the Commerce and Health Department both share regulatory responsibilities related to enforcing parity statutes here in Minnesota, both the state and federal parity requirements. I don't have a comprehensive list of our activities thus far, although we could put one together for you, but suffice it to say we have been engaged in this issue, and I think me and the health plans could verify that for you. I think one of the potential concerns with a task force approach would be that we have been engaged on an individual plan-by-plan basis with our colleagues at the health department to have discussions with the plans about what is actually being reported and what analyses the plans are actually doing, which occurs prior to them submitting information to the department during the rate review process. Those conversations have been cordial, they've been productive, and they are ongoing. I think our concern is if you put together a task force, you will not be able to have that level of conversation on an individual plan-by-plan basis because the plans will not be able to speak candidly in front of their competitors about what's actually happening in each individual setting. So I think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Davids, I understand the approach that you are advocating here, and typically, you know, that sort of let's get in a room together and figure out the solution, I agree, is oftentimes something that we do around here. But in this particular case, I don't think it would actually be as productive as it would be to pass the underlying bill. And Mr. Chairman, if I might as well, I think one of the things in the Delete All Amendment that we have found is that there is an opaqueness to this issue. An opaqueness to this issue of non-quantitative treatment limitations. And so having some additional reporting requirements there based on data that I think the plans are typically already collecting, I think would be helpful to the departments in our analysis of whether or not plans that are filed with the department are meeting the parity requirements as they're being attested to in the filings.
And Representative David, if I might, if we pass this bill without your amendment, might the patients actually be on an equal footing with the insurance companies?
Well, Mr. Chairman, they already are.
They certainly don't seem to be. When somebody has 6 weeks of sitting at home waiting for to be denied coverage, no, that doesn't seem like they're on an equal footing, especially when you have a parent who doesn't know what they're really getting themselves into, working against an organization whose whole purpose is to make rules and follow rules. So if the representative from NAMI would like to say, would like to add to this?
Well, Mr.
Go right ahead.
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak to the proposed amendment. So one of the reasons we changed our bill this year is because we heard from the plans that they didn't want to do that kind of big paperwork analysis, although it is being done in other states. And so we went back to have just the kind of core pieces of information that they already collect. And I know that some of you are new, and I don't often come to Commerce, but we are known for working out compromises with people. We are known for taking on very deep, difficult issues and figuring out how to move forward. But I'm going to tell you that I've spent two summers asking the plan, saying you don't need this legislation to come forward, task force, to really talk about what data you can provide, and they did not do that. And so I'm feeling like we have tried, we have come together with, you know, with language we could work on, but we hear these stories every single day, and we're just not willing to wait any longer. And the data that we're asking for in the amended bill is information that they already have.
David, you would like to speak to what I said?
Both, actually.
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, this bill is not a compromise. This is not a compromise. When one side is heavy-handedly pushing against another, that is not a compromise. And that's exactly what's happening here. Okay, there's no compromise here. But we need to get back to the question and to the chairman's comments. Current law is not being enforced. Do we have to pass a law that says, oh, we really mean it? We should do this? The law is there. It needs to be enforced. And last year when this working group was put together, and it was in the final bill that the governor vetoed, that's the approach we need to take. We need to have a balanced approach where both sides have something to say. They both get to say, this is a very heavy-handed one side. I want everybody to win. We need a win-win, and it's not happening with this bill. And if this amendment doesn't go on, this bill doesn't happen.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Oh, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a comment to maybe the Commerce Department. It sounds like, you know, your fear or not worry potentially with this is that some of the plans are concerned about their, talking about potential secrets or kind of the way they're going about their business in a public forum, and you feel that some of those, is there a way that you could maybe produce a document that, you know, from a blind side where we're not hearing exactly from which they are so they can hear their comments so that maybe that could be part of the solution, assuming Representative David's amendment goes on? Or, you know, is there, you know, you feel like, you know, in a public forum, maybe they're not going to be as free to speak? And, you know, what are your thoughts along those lines?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, appreciate the question. I think that's what we're actually doing right now. I think after the bill that was not enacted into law last year that would have established a similar kind of task force, the departments, Commerce and Health, started to reach out to the plans and have that very dialogue individually. I think we are conscious of not wanting to, you know, violate that regulated entity conversation. And so we haven't broached the topic with plans individually about what do we produce after this. But I think the focus has been how do we improve the rate review process and the network review process that we conduct on an annual basis so that we have better information from the plans to inform whether or not the parity standards are being met, and to utilize the existing system that we have to provide some better window for the regulatory agencies into what's actually happening for consumers. Mr. Chair, I think the task force may not necessarily allow us to have that kind of conversation with plans individually because they will not be able to have the kind of direct conversation that they're able to have when we meet with them one-on-one. So long answer to your question, but Representative, I think we're doing that now.
Any other questions? Any other questions? Any final comments on your amendment, Representative David?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just say that the argument that Commerce is making is a fallacy, that you have to have private means. You can't concurrently have a working group. That's nonsense. I'd appreciate member support.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The amendment fails. Back to the original bill as amended. House File 1340. Representative Lean, did you have any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I certainly appreciate the very spirited debate here today. And really, especially, I want to thank the families for coming out and sharing those stories, that's very heartbreaking. I have a good friend who suffers from mental health issues, and so I've also seen his family, you know, go through a lot of these crises and situations. And, you know, I would just say, I mean, the federal mental health parity law was passed 10 years ago, so we've had 10 years for the policies essentially to figure out how to work this out, how to provide the coverage and everything. And this is not mandating benefits. It's mandating parity in the way processes go in place for coverage. So I don't know that another government directive for them to get together and talk through this is completely necessary. I hadn't really seen the amendment before today. I know the health plans came into my office briefly the other day just to speak about it, but I haven't had real in-depth conversations about how this task force would look or anything. But again, if we're going to take governmental action here to help these families, you know, I don't know that a task force is the best way to do it, to continue to talk about this problem for another year. The health plans have this information. If it was given to the Department of Commerce, the department would better be able to enforce mental health parity. And, you know, just to speak to the issue that this is a one-sided conversation, well, in my mind, for the last 10 years, it has been a one-sided conversation. We have families who are suffering through crises, losing loved ones, not being able to get the help and the services that, quite frankly, they're paying for through health insurance premiums right now. So, members, I just would really appreciate your support on this bill. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, the chair will renew his motion to re-refer House File 1340 as amended to the HHS Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members.
I'd like to call up the author of 766. This will be done. Is there any further? I will take House File 766 off the table. In the there are multiple other committees meeting, and we all have to keep moving. I have a series of questions that I'll probably ask offline. So we have this House File 766 before us. Is there any more discussion? Any more discussion? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion to re-refer House File 766 to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be referred to the HHS Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
You are on your way.
Thank you, Chair.
Do we have any more business before the committee?
It was stupid creation. It was stupidly implemented, stupidly used.
Members, we have members. The audience needs to be quiet because we have further work to do tonight. We will be coming back to room 200. At 7 o'clock, for I don't know which particular bill, but I'm sure we've all been talked to about it. Gotten a few emails about it. Okay, and I want, if you're a member of the public who is looking to talk, to watch the next bill at 7 o'clock, you'll have to get a ticket to get in. So bring your stuff with you. You will not be able to get back in the room without a ticket. Members, at this time we stand in recess till 7 o'clock, room 200.
Good evening. Thanks for being here. I am reconvening the Commerce Committee, March 12th, 2019. We will be hearing House File 12. Before we do that, because this is the Commerce Committee and because this had, I believe, quite a lengthy hearing in its last committee stop, we want to be sure that we are focused on the purview of this committee, and I'm wondering if our nonpartisan staff would be willing to let us know what is under the purview of Commerce in this bill.
Certainly, Madam Chair and members. Commerce will be focusing on page 2, beginning on line 9. This is section 3. This adds a subdivision prohibiting misrepresentation, false or misleading statements, false promises, and that'll be coded in our consumer protection statutes.
Thank you for that. And so for everybody who is going to be presenting and testifying, I would encourage you to keep that in mind. My intention is to have public testimony run an hour. The bill author will have time to present his bill and present with his testifiers, and then we'll try to keep testimony limited to 2 minutes regarding consumer protection. And with that, I will move House File 12 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Cantrell, I understand you have an author's amendment. Is that correct? Or
yes, Madam Chair. We have an author's amendment. And essentially what it does is, after consultation with various stakeholders, as well as concerned entities such as the ACLU, we came to a consensus that this is an amendment that will help to really strengthen the intention of this bill and to ensure that that we clear up a little bit of the misconception around what would be still permissible and what would be impermissible should this bill be enacted into law.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. I will move the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment, to that author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cantrell, to your bill as amended.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. I have to, first of all, apologize for keeping you for another late night of hearings. But nonetheless, it is my pleasure to present to you this evening House File 12. A bill that will ban the widely discredited and demonstrably harmful practice of conversion therapy in the state of Minnesota. This bill fits squarely within our jurisdiction and our responsibility as a legislature to ensure that consumers are not exploited and harmed by fraudulent products and that we protect the well-being of children. As Chair Halverson has indicated, the focus of our conversation and my testimony and the testimony of the testifier shall be focused on the consumer protection component of this bill, which is Section 3. For the sake of clarity and expediency, I want to ensure that that I give ample foundational clarification as to the impact and contents of this bill. Conversion therapy, as defined in Section 3 of this bill, means services or products that are intended to change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity, including efforts to change behaviors and gender expression, or to eliminate or reduce sexual or romantic attractions or feelings towards individuals of the same gender. My testifiers, who are the brave survivors of conversion therapy, will outline the traumatic and unscientific practices to which they were subjected and the resultant lifelong detriment to their health and well-being these practices have inflicted upon them. Conversion therapy differs from bona fide therapy in numerous ways. Conversion therapy seeks to have a desired outcome of changing someone's sexuality or gender identity. Legitimate therapy is not conducted through this lens. Rather, legitimate therapy supports self-directed patient exploration of one's sexuality and gender identity in an unbiased manner that is supportive of the individual patient's journey of self-understanding. As a matter of preempting some misconceptions of this bill, let me be clear. If someone who thinks they may be gay, for example, visits a mental health professional and seeks assistance in navigating through their sexuality, that mental health professional is absolutely not mandated under this bill to only tell that patient that they are gay. Rather, that mental health professional, as all legitimate mental health professionals should do, will help a patient navigate through these questions in their own way, with the only desired outcome being that the patient is happy and healthy. Sexuality is not a choice, and it cannot be changed. And someone who portrays a service that they offer as being capable of such is deceiving both patients and their families. The legislature has long set the scope of practice for practitioners. and this bill does not undermine the patient-practitioner relationship. Rather, it seeks to affirm the integrity of the mental health field as a whole. Under this bill, people can still preach their religious views and understanding of sexuality, sell books, hold conferences for which tickets are sold, and guide people through prayer. This bill was specifically crafted and further refined to avoid conflict with religious liberties and the freedom of speech, foundational tenets of our republic that I hold dear. What this bill says is that in the state of Minnesota, we will not allow anyone, through deceptive means, to financially exploit the inner turmoil that so many people in our state experience. This bill also prohibits the subjection of children, many of whom cannot advocate for themselves and are faced with the threat of familial estrangement, should they object, to the practice of conversion therapy. The practice of conversion therapy has led directly to the suicides of countless people in our state and across our country, and has absolutely no place within the scope of the high-quality healthcare standard that we as Minnesotans take pride in and strive to continuously build upon. This bill will not only save lives, it will mitigate immense harm and prevent the exploitation of patients and their family in the state of Minnesota. I would like to underscore for everyone that conversion therapy, and for the purpose of clarifying semantics, the therapies that bear its likeness in every measurable way, though seek to draw a distinction from what is often popularized as being aspects of conversion therapy, but however remain essentially synonymous in the practices and biases employed, have been disavowed and discredited by every major medical organization and prominent and many prominent local healthcare entities. Letters of support for this bill, from some of which you will find included in your packets. It is my firm belief that these organizations and practitioners would not so fervently oppose this practice if it had any merit or appearance of efficacy in the practice of patient care. Nor do I assess that opposition to these to the practices employed in conversion therapy would garner such condemnation from these groups if these practices were not directly and demonstrably linked to severe harm inflicted upon people who are subjected to them. In close, members, I would like to quote a very well-respected statesman. A suicide epidemic has touched all sectors of our society, but the problem is particularly acute among LGBT youth, who experience bullying and discrimination at every turn. In the most devastating cases, these teenagers even face estrangement from their own families. It is a call to action to Americans of all political stripes, regardless of where you stand on the cultural issues of today, whether you are a religious conservative, a secular liberal, or somewhere in between. We all have a special duty to each other. That duty is to treat one another with dignity and respect. It is not simply to tolerate, but to love. Members, let us be a part of the solution and take great heed of retired U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch's words. At this time, Madam Chair, I will turn the presentation over to my first testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Junior Avalos, and I'm a survivor of conversion therapy, and I'm here in support for HF12. Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, thank you so much for taking time to hear me today. I went through conversion therapy because I was young and in a vulnerable state. When I was outed at the age of 10, rather than taking time to process what I was going through, I was immediately shunned by my family and faith community for the feelings that I was having. As I was growing up, I was being forced to sit with girls in my congregation to potentially stir up feelings. I was told I could not have physical contact with my male friends because that could risk me having emotional feelings for them. I was being told obscure lies to scare me about having feelings for other guys. They were trying to scare me straight. While all this was happening, I wasn't changing. I was still having a hidden relationship with other guys and my grade, and all of this self-hate that was being taught to me led me to risky behavior. At age 16, I had a breaking point when I was outed again. I was being threatened that I would be abandoned by my family. I was being told that if I didn't change, I was going to lose the people that I loved. And so in a desperate attempt to be loved by the people that I loved, I was willing to do whatever. I found a website that advertised that I could be cured of my same-sex attraction. They used language that said that they could cure me, that I could be fixed, that my same-sex attraction was just some inherent feeling that was fixable. It was a two-week program, and it cost me $600. I was 16, so I got a job working at a fast food restaurant, paying for it, and I mixed in the consent forms to attend with some paperwork for a dance intensive I was also planning to attend so that my mom was unaware of what I was doing. This camp gave me the impression that I could be fixed and that by attending I could be accepted as a straight man. However, these people had no medical background. They manipulated me and others that attended this camp into thinking that there was trauma that was causing us to be gay, but this was a lie. It was it was mostly kids. We were ranging from the age of 13 to the age of 22. They used verbal and physical tactics, often abusive, to condition us to behave differently and use different mannerisms. Mannerisms that they decided were straight mannerisms. One example of this was that we would have to practice of trying to act masculine by talking in a deep voice or positioning our bodies in specific ways. If we didn't, then we risked physical assault, and they beat us like dogs because of it. I left there hating myself even more, distressing the entire world and contemplating suicide. So I urge the committee to support this bill. This bill will protect an entire population from falling prey to the lies of the people that claim that they can fix something that doesn't need fixing. This bill would uplift our current consumer fraud laws and prevent people from trying to sell this snake oil and profiting from the pain and suffering of others. I urge you to pass this legislation. I know what good therapy looks like. I'm a person of faith now, and I know that I was born perfect, and the stuff that I went through shouldn't be allowed in this state. Because of this, this bill, it's not fair that any kid, and in any case, has to go through something barbaric and harmful practice. So I urge everyone in the committee to vote yes on this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with us. Next, Dr. Margaret Cermoli. Welcome to the committee. Next up will be Sandra Simonson. We'll just make sure everybody's on deck so that we'll need Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chairperson Halverson and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Margaret Cermoli. I am past president of the Minnesota Psychological Association, a former member of the American Psychological Association Council of Representatives, which is its governing body, and a Minnesota licensed psychologist. I have a private practice in St. Paul, and I have taught doctoral level psychology courses on ethics and sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Psychological Association, which supports the passage of House File 12 to ban the use of conversion therapy. MPA stands with many other mainstream mental health and medical associations which denounce conversion therapy and its correlates. These associations include, but are not limited to, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Counseling Association, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Association of Social Workers, and the American Psychoanalytic Association. In offering my testimony, I'm going to make five important points. I will also be talking about the American Psychological Association's stance because it is the same as Minnesota's, and I was a member of the American Psychological Association governing body when it developed policy statements about conversion therapy. The Minnesota Psychological Association, MPA, and the American Psychological Association, APA, oppose the use of conversion therapy because it violates our ethical standards, it is unlikely to work, is associated with harm and serious risks, fails to meet acceptable standards of care, and is discriminatory. Our ethical standards, number one, our ethical standards prohibit us from making false, deceptive, or fraudulent statements about the scientific or clinical basis for our services. Conversion therapy and its correlates, such as reparative therapy, are based on the false and deceptive premises, beliefs, and implications that same-sex attractions and romantic desires are signs of a mental disorder. The purpose of it is to change sexual orientation. And by 1974, both the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association, the primary arbiters of what constitutes mental illness in this country, concluded that homosexuality is not a psychological or developmental disorder. They based their decisions on a substantial body of scientific research that refuted those erroneous beliefs. This then begs the question, 45 years later, about conversion therapy. If something isn't broken, why are some people trying to fix it? Recipients of conversion therapy have also been led to believe that they will have miserable lives, unhealthy relationships, and won't be good parents. A solid body of reputable scientific research has refuted all those beliefs and assumptions. MPA and APA recognize that homosexuality is a normal variant of sexual orientation, that it is not a mental disorder, and that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people can lead happy lives, have healthy relationships, and be good parents. Furthermore, APA policy, quote, advises parents, guardians, young people, and their families to avoid sexual orientation change efforts that portray homosexuality as a mental illness, unquote. Secondly, conversion therapy is unlikely to be successful. An APA task force charged with reviewing scientific research on efforts to change sexual orientation examined over 80 studies and concluded that evidence failed to warrant its use. Simply put, it wasn't likely to work. As a result of that, APA policy, quote, encourages mental health professionals to avoid misrepresenting the efficacy of sexual orientation change efforts by promoting or promising change in sexual orientation when providing assistance to individuals distressed by their own or other sexual orientation. Number three, conversion therapy has been associated with harmful effects and serious risks. These effects and risks include depression, distress, shame, suicidality, increased substance use, high-risk sexual behaviors, increased self-hatred, and negative perceptions about same-sex attractions. I can attest to those harmful effects as a clinician who has worked with clients who have been through conversion therapy and been to the brink of suicide. Number four, conversion therapy fails to meet acceptable standards of care. Licensed healthcare professionals are expected to act in accordance with professional standards of conduct and care in order to protect consumers. That means that we need to set aside our personal beliefs and that we don't get to say whatever we want when providing services to others. It is not an infringement on our freedom of speech to expect us to adhere to ethical and professional conduct and standards of care when providing healthcare services to the public. If conversion therapy isn't an acceptable standard of care, what is? Well, acceptable standards of care and appropriate therapeutic responses to people who experience distress related to their sexual orientation recognize that this distress is not related to sexual orientation per se and is due instead to external factors such as being a member of a marginalized and stigmatized group that is forced to deal with prejudice, discrimination, hate crimes, and family rejection. Acceptable standards of care offer affirmative, multicultural, competent approaches that help people understand stress, develop positive coping skills, nurture resilience, seek social support, and get accurate information about sexual orientation and same-sex relationships. These approaches have been shown to be effective, evidence-based practices that are associated with positive outcomes in therapy. Finally, conversion therapy is discriminatory. Our ethical standards, like the State of Minnesota Human Rights Act, oppose discrimination based on sexual orientation. No, not once, has conversion therapy ever been used to change heterosexual feelings or behavior. Conversion therapy is only aimed at changing gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Hence, it is discriminatory. In conclusion, the Minnesota Psychological Association supports the passage of House File 12. We oppose conversion therapy because it is based on false and misleading beliefs and practices. It is unlikely to be successful, is associated with harm and serious risks, fails to meet acceptable standards of care, and is discriminatory. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sandra Simonson, followed by Jack Richter.
Madam Chair, as they're coming up, just a quick question for
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we keeping the testimony to 2 minutes and just within Section 3? Is that the plan?
Representative O'Neill, that is the plan for public testimony. This is the author's presentation of the bill. Thank you. Ms. Simonson, welcome to the committee. Okay.
Thank you. You can state your name and proceed.
Yep. I'm Sandra K. Simonson, licensed independent clinical social worker. One of four ways to be licensed as a therapist in Minnesota. I have been licensed as a therapist for 25-plus years. A therapist who has lived and worked in South Central Minnesota, yes, that includes rural Minnesota, and also the outer metro suburbs. Plus, I have worked in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I was working in Minnesota before social workers were licensed to do mental health therapy in Minnesota. So I have seen 30 years of work by licensed professionals, educators, consumers, and legislators to continue to strengthen protections for mental health consumers in Minnesota. When licensed professional counselors became the fourth way to be licensed as a therapist in Minnesota, legislation was drafted so education, licensing, and continuing education would be uniform across all four professions. The expectation was accountability. What House File 12 does is continue the legacy of protections for mental health consumers in Minnesota. The protections sought in House File 12 reminds us that all of mental health loses integrity if one population group is not offered the same protections as fellow mental health consumers. Protections such as providers that are licensed and practice on a basis of professional ethics. The social work profession has the ethic that social workers obtain education about and seek to understand the nature of social diversity and oppression. This includes with respect to sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression. The argument made by opposition that a therapist's First Amendment rights are infringed upon by this bill is in dangerous contradiction to professional licensing and ethics. The first ethical standard of social work is social workers' ethical responsibility to clients. The four licensing boards in Minnesota, which license therapists, also have standards of practice included in Minnesota statutes that prohibit discrimination. Finally, while out-of-state therapists have provided testimony to this legislature in opposition to House File 12, I ask that Minnesota licensed therapists have the influence with our own legislators to continue the legacy of protecting mental health consumers in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Jack Richter. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Jack Richter from Sartell, Minnesota. I want to thank the committee for generously listening to this bill and taking it into consideration. I am here as a 12-year survivor of the ex-gay movement. The previous people that spoke are licensed therapists, and I see this room is filled with people who have self-esteem, who have gotten to where they are because of that self-esteem. And I'm here to tell you that when a person is 21, 22 years old as I was, and I was sat down by my ex-sister, who I will never see again, and told that I was going to burn in hell for being a gay man and that I would never see my mom or my dad again, and that there was no chance of me to ever see them again and I would burn in hell. But the Lord took away all her lesbian feelings, and she met her husband because of the Lord, and he could do the same for me. And then she gave me a whole bunch of propaganda from Outpost Ministries and Exodus International. I actually have the original propaganda from Outpost, and what that movement did to me was it completely destroyed any shred of self-esteem I might have had. At the age of 21, 22, I had never, ever studied or looked at evolutionary biology. I had never studied or looked at human sexuality because being raised as a Catholic, we did not have that option. We were told what to think. And in the ex-gay movement, you are told what to think. And I am here also on behalf of Angela Emick, who was my dear friend, who did suicide because of the ex-gay movement. I survived, and I vowed that I would be here tonight to tell you that this bill would save lives, because the ex-gay movement does not save lives. It blows apart and rips apart families. It does not save families, because when I was in the movement, it was for 12 years. So what happened when I was in the movement was men would actually leave their gay partner who they had been with for years and years and years. And after they left their partner, they would marry a woman. I was in it that long. And then they would cheat on their wife with the ex-partner. Now, is that integrity? Is that honesty? Is that ethics? Is that humanity? Is that living? I just ask you all that. I'll never see my friend Angela again. And the reason why I don't believe I'll see her again is because not only did the ex-gay movement take away my family, blow it apart, it took away any shred of chance at an operatic career because I was going for a career in opera, but what it took away my belief in a God. I had to research atheism, and I found all the arguments for that. So what I'm saying to all of you who are religious folk here, and I say this with respect, if you go against this bill and you choose to present an ex-gay idealship to your children, you could be driving them away from the very religion that you promote. And they could research and research and do the research and research their way right out of faith, period, into atheism. Because what a child at 22 years old needs is love. They need love and acceptance and rationality. This is a book called Prayers for Bobby. I urge every one of you to see this in this room. It was a movie made into a movie with Sigourney Weaver. It's the real life of a boy whose mother was relentless on telling him that he needed to become straight, and she wrote Bible verses, and it wasn't good enough, and he was never good enough for her, so he threw himself over a bridge in front of an oncoming semi-truck and killed himself. And what did the mother do after that? She became one of the biggest leading pro-gay proponents of Lambda. And she went around speaking because she has to live every day with the feeling that she was the one to cause her son to kill himself. This book, Boy Erased, was just made into a movie starring Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe. It was just in theaters in November. I urge you, please, before you make a decision on this bill, please just watch these movies because they're real stories. This boy was in the ex-gay movement, as I was. I've never seen anybody change their orientation in the ex-gay movement. To this day, I was in the movement for 12 years. I dream about men. I don't dream about women. I never have once. It's not changeable. Orientation is not changeable. I have pictures of Angela if anybody would like to see any of them. And I love you, Angela, and I know I won't see you anymore. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and I'm sorry about the loss of your friends. That concludes the author's presentation. We will move to public testimony. This will public testimony will take as many people as signed up for an hour, and asking you all to keep time to 2 minutes apiece. The first, you can watch Amy for timing. She's got signs, so it's hard to know. Time up there goes fast. So, the first testifier on the list is Nate Oilo, followed by Emma McBride. And if you guys can all kind of cue, that way we'll make sure we can get as many people as possible. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Nate Oilo, Nathan Oilo. Good morning, or good evening. This was supposed to be earlier. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nathan Oilo, and I oppose this bill. As an adolescent, I experienced same-sex attractions. Knowing that homosexual practice was inconsistent with my religious faith, I chose to explore my options with the help of qualified mental health professionals and pastoral caregivers. I was not forced, I was not coerced, I was not abused. In fact, I was honored and loved, and that I was given the power of choice and the dignity to think for myself. I do want to add that I went through Outpost Ministries programming and am very thankful for my experience there. In addition to professional and pastoral help, I also benefited from many books and curricula and conferences that supported my desire to bring my same-sex attractions into agreement with my religious faith. 20 years later, I still look back fondly on all the resources that were available to me, all of which set me up for the life that I wanted. Furthermore, as a pastor, I've worked with many young people over the past 20 years who are questioning their sexual orientation or gender identity, and like me, wanting to bring their sexual orientation and gender identity into agreement with their faith. These young people were given the same love, honor, and dignity afforded me in my youth, the power of choice and the dignity to think for themselves. In my work as a pastor, and I hope one day to put my story in book form. Under this bill, I could be prosecuted for fraud if I was thought to be promoting conversion therapy, which is vaguely defined. If someone holds a different view than me on gender identity and sexuality and interpreted my statements to be misleading, my work would be considered consumer fraud. I am not a fraud. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
I also have testimonies from others who testified at the last hearing. I would love for you to read them and consider them.
You can, one of our pages will pick that up and pass it out. Emma McBride, followed by Bob Robbie.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma McBride, and I work in policy and legislative affairs at Outfront Minnesota, which is the state's largest LGBTQ advocacy org. I'm here today because of the sheer bravery of survivors of conversion therapy who have come forward to share their stories in hopes that nobody goes through the same kind of trauma that they have. The members of this committee have been given a copy of an Ozane Foundation study, and I'd like to highlight the most important findings, which show that conversion therapy is ineffective at its purpose, but very effective at leading to mental health issues, including suicide. These distressing findings should be enough on their own to put a stop to this practice. The study was overseen by an influential board, advisory board consisting of some of the most senior statistical, religious, and healthcare professionals in the UK. Of the people who experienced conversion therapy, over half said they experienced mental health issues following attempts to change, and nearly half stated that they had found it hard to accept themselves for who they are following attempts to change. Of those who suffered mental health issues, nearly one-third said they attempted suicide, while over two-thirds said they had suicidal thoughts. I will repeat that. Over two-thirds said they had suicidal thoughts following conversion therapy. Less than a third said that they had gone on to lead a happy and fulfilled life. Only a small minority of respondents sought advice from actual National Health Service or private medical professionals, meaning that a vast majority of respondents who went through efforts to change their sexuality did so with unlicensed providers. They were sold pseudoscience, harmful services for something that is not a disease. Providers, unlicensed and licensed, are ignoring the significant research that shows the extent of harm caused by conversion therapy, research that is backed up by every single major medical association and the UN, who have likened this to torture. I urge you to use your vote to protect people from dangerous and discredited conversion therapy practices. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Bob Robbie, followed by Ben Feist. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Robbie, R-O-B-Y. I'm a family law case evaluator, experienced as a guardian ad litem. I also advise legal clients who are therapists and mental health professionals. I work weekly with cases where children are in therapy. This is very real in the trenches issue for me. I am a person of faith, and I guess to me that means that I know that God loves us as we are, not as we should be. That's what I know. I'm invested in this issue. We can't allow this issue to continue to polarize us. It's not good for anybody, especially kids. Especially kids. They get caught in the middle of polarization in our culture, in our families. I have two concerns about this bill, and I want to Yes, and I want to get to, and I want to focus on Section 3, and my comments do so as well. I noticed that my written submission was not here, out here to tonight behind me, so it's, I guess it's not available for people unless there's copies offered at the end. But to my two points of concern about this bill, one is the definition of conversion therapy itself. My concern is that no one goes to therapy so they can stay the same. No one goes to therapy so they can stay the same. In the real world, people go so they can change something. They want change in their life. Now, if people are allowed to change, then the law, I don't think, has any business preferring one gender identity over another. And the concern here is the intrusion into the therapist-patient relationship and trying to create a one-way street there is a problem. Kids don't need this fight brought into their therapy sessions, and I hope that this will be reconsidered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roby. And for members' information, the handout that Mr. Roby referenced is in your packets. It says Minnesota Mediation Services, LLC, at the top, so you can find that. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota, and I'm here today in support of this bill. This is good policy for Minnesota. And I was really asked to try to take a look at this from a constitutional perspective. It's not often that I get to come on this side. I'm usually in front of this body saying for sure this is unconstitutional. But after doing my research here, I can say that this certainly fits as a reasonable prohibition. So generally speaking, bills like this that are limited to the provision of conversion therapy services don't raise free speech issues. And although a physician's professional communication is constitutionally protected, we also know under a long series of case law that it may be reasonably restricted if the regulation is consistent with the norms of medical practice. We've already heard from experts in the field today that a prohibition on this practice makes sense from those who are practitioners. So specifically to the consumer protection piece, I'll also add that when it's okay to prohibit conversion therapy for profit, it also makes sense to prohibit offers to sell conversion therapy. So I think we are well within the scope of adding this provision to Minnesota's consumer protection statutes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. David Kirby, followed by Will Sampson Bernstrom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, good evening, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Dr. David Kirby. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist who's been in practice in the state of Minnesota for 25 years. I want you to imagine that you are a consumer entering a surgical center for a surgery you believe will save your life. You have received thousands of substantiated health claims from others saying that it saved their lives. No one has told you to go, not even your parents. The surgeon sighs and tells you that a small clinic was shut down because unlicensed non-professionals had been using switchblades, conversion therapy, for their surgeries. You say, good, I'm glad they shut it down. That practice sounds very harmful. But why are you telling me this? The surgeon replies that as a result of the 5% of surgeries being done with the switchblades, all knives have been banned across the state, even scalpels used by professional surgeons. This is therapy that is heterosexual affirmative. She then tells you if she performs the surgery you are pleading for, her healthcare efforts will be prosecuted as a criminal act. As you are leaving the surgical center depressed, another doctor grabs you by the arm and announces that some scalpels have not been banned. There's an exception. Scalpels are freely available for surgeries if they are used in a manner mandated by the government for gay-affirmative therapy. HF-12 begins with the objective of protecting one minority from conversion therapy, fine and good. But then the bill discriminates against another minority by dictating that all individuals with same-sex attraction are only allowed to receive gay affirmative therapy. Heterosexual affirmative therapy, even in your request, is banned. At a very minimum, this bill discriminates against children who are struggling with unwanted SSA because they are sexually abused, even by same-sex adults. So my final point is I oppose this bill because it discriminates against the health care of some of our children in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Will Sampson Bernstrom, followed by Michael Newlands. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Will Sampson Bernstrom. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am a faith leader at Apple Valley Community of Christ, and I am a survivor of conversion therapy. From 2006 to 2010, I participated in counseling sessions across Alabama, Northwest Florida, and participated in a weekend Exodus International Conference in Memphis, Tennessee. Sometimes I'd sit with a parent while a counselor tried to identify a non-existent trauma that obviously made me gay. When my parents weren't present, the blame would be shifted to them. I was told that some internalized anger or resentment towards them might unlock the secret to my sickness. In March 2009, after living my worst nightmare of being publicly outed, I offered to return to therapy in order to stay in my private Christian school. Although I would go to a licensed therapist for over a year, I was still kicked out of my school for being told that I was a threat to the other students. After being told by my community that I was a threat that needed to be protected from, and having resisted opportunities to change, I allowed a therapist week after week to tamper with my memories. The details are traumatic, and there are moments in my life that when I reflect on, I only see a bright light. I liken it to a DVR. Someone went through with a remote and deleted files that they didn't think that I needed anymore. As for the long-term effects, I suffer from depression, anxiety, PTSD, and suicidal ideation. These interfere with my everyday life. Imagine living your life after spending crucial years of development, being told that you are living a sin that hurts and threatens others, a sin that you can erase if you are just more of a man or erase key memories. I would urge the committee to please support this bill and stand up for the survivors of this torturous practice.
Thank you for your testimony. Michael Newland, followed by Alisa Tomet. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Michael Newland. At the age of 11 or 12, I realized I was attracted exclusively to the same sex. This was quite problematic for me because it was in conflict with how my faith informed me to live out my sexuality. And for me, my faith was much more important than embracing a sexual identity at odds with my faith. I believed my sexual orientation could change, but I was incapable of bringing that about on my own. I was miserable and increasingly engaging in self-destructive behaviors and thought patterns. I needed help in reconciling my faith and my sexuality and in resolving deep emotional issues. And so at the age of 17, I sought out help in reconciling that conflict. I paid for services consisting primarily of talk therapy and spiritual guidance. I also purchased books and admission to events that talked about faith and sexuality, including the possibility of sexual orientation change. These resources encouraged me to explore issues in my life that may have contributed to the development of same-sex attractions. These resources helped me to become confident in and be at peace with who I am, even in the midst of having same-sex attractions. As I worked through a myriad of issues, my sexual attractions toward men gradually diminished. I no longer identify as same-sex attracted. In fact, I am happily married to a woman and am genuinely attracted to her. The resources I had access to helped make all of this possible and contributed to a holistic, positive life change. I am concerned that this legislation would make it difficult for others to explore the option of sexual orientation change in accordance with their faith and core values. The resources that helped me were not false or misleading. But under this bill, someone who has a differing viewpoint of gender and sexuality could categorize them as misleading and sue for consumer fraud. It is not the government's place to prohibit people from pursuing help or from providing resources to help others in accordance with their core values when it comes to such intimate matters of faith and conscience. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Alisa Tomet, followed by Jason Knoll. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good evening. Excuse me. My name is Dr. Alisa Tomet. I am a doctor of public health with a Master of Science degree in counseling psychology. However, I speak to you today as a mother. I am a proud Christian mother of a young lesbian woman, and I am a Minnesota mama bear. Mama bears are mothers of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer children who love and fight to protect our own and every other child, no matter where they find themselves on the sexuality or gender identity spectrums. We fight to protect our kids just as fiercely as a mother bear protects her cubs from ignorance, hate, violence, social injustice, and abuse, which are often perpetuated by misguided laws and public policy. I've been asked here today to read a letter on behalf of the parents of a young man who survived conversion therapy, but not without significant emotional and financial cost to the family. These parents were deceived by false, misleading, and fraudulent statements and guarantees that their child could be cured from homosexuality through conversion therapy. A Minnesota father writes, "Dear Madam Chair and the Minnesota House Commerce Committee, my name is David Bernstrom. I am a resident of Becker, Minnesota, and the father of Will Samson Bernstrom, who previously testified. When our son came out as gay, his mother and I were ignorant as to the hows, whys, and whats of homosexuality and decided to meet with a therapist. Our initial meeting was the only meeting that we were allowed to attend together with our son, even though he was a minor. This therapist's theory was that our son's homosexuality was a result of a sexual assault that had occurred earlier in his life and that identifying this life-altering event would lead to our son's conversion. The possibility that our son had been sexually abused was alone reason enough to continue seeking treatment for him. This therapist was not a doctor, so we continued looking for more legitimate therapists. Another therapist recommended attending the Exodus International Seminar in Nashville, Tennessee, and we traveled to Nashville to endure another weekend of sessions with our son meeting with the counselor without the parents being in attendance. Neither therapist nor Exodus International personnel showed us any studies that proved conversion therapy was a legitimate scientific practice or that traumatic events lead to homosexuality. Out of desperation to help our son, we blindly trusted their professional credentials.
Dr. Tomet, I'm afraid that's the 2 minutes that you have. However, if you would like to submit that written testimony to the committee, you're welcome to, and we will distribute it to community members as well.
Okay, we thank you. And on behalf of the Minnesota Mama Bears and all parents of LGBT plus kids for considering this measure.
Thank you for your testimony. Jason Knoll, followed by Pastor Brennan Blue. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Jason Knoll. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jason Knoll. I already said that, but I oppose this bill. I am concerned that this bill will take away the books, conferences, and counseling services that were vital to me in overcoming unwanted same-sex attractions. As an adolescent and young adult, I struggled with SSA. My desire was to eventually be married to a woman, but I didn't know if there was any help for me. In 2002, I was driving home from work late at night, listening to Christian radio, when I heard a man give his testimony about walking away from homosexuality and how there were many other people who had done the same. This was the message I had been waiting for most of my life. As soon as I got home that night, I went online and began looking at all the resources, such as ministries, books, and conferences that were available to help someone like me. I called and set up counseling appointments with amazing, wonderful people who were always kind, supportive, and professional. I purchased books authored by people like Dr. Elizabeth Moberly, Leanne Payne, Dr. Joseph Nicolosi, and many others. Their psychological and spiritual insights taught me the reasons behind my SSA and how to get those needs met in healthy ways. I attended multiple conferences where I got to hear doctors, psychologists, pastors, and lay people speak on the myriad of issues associated with SSA. During these conferences, I received prayer counseling, attended support groups, and purchased additional resources such as books, CDs, DVDs, and MP3s. I also received great encouragement from hearing personal testimonies of others who walked away from homosexuality and SSA. Through these valuable resources, I was able to realize my goal to live as a man who is now secure in my heterosexuality and has been married to my beautiful wife for over 8 years. Under the expansive language of this bill, resources like the ones that helped me could be interpreted as misleading. Please do not pass this bill or take away the freedom of choice for others like me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Pastor Brennan Blue, followed by Emily Zinos. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Reverend Brennan Blue. I'm the senior pastor at St. Luke Presbyterian Church in Minnetonka. I am here today on behalf of my congregation and the over 14,000 members of the Presbytery of the Twin Cities, both of whom have publicly endorsed HF12. One of the things that I love about my faith tradition is the theological conviction that all people are made beautifully and purposely in the image of God. All people, regardless of the color of your skin, who you're attracted to, all people are made beautifully in the image of God. In the 8 years of my professional ministry, unfortunately, I found that time and time again, this great hope has been excluded and withheld from members of the LGBTQ community by not only the church, but by the state as well. I have witnessed firsthand in pastoral care and counseling sessions how the harmful, manipulative messaging of conversion therapies wounds people to the core, both spiritually and emotionally. I have wept, and I have prayed with friends and colleagues who have been scarred for life by this practice. We have heard tonight and will continue to hear arguments about the intention and hopes of conversion therapy. I asked us to recognize that regardless of whatever the intent or theology of the practice may be, its impact is overwhelmingly akin to a psychological hate crime. Madam Chair, I submit that this is not who we are as a state, and that this is not what the majority of our faith communities want. Conversion therapies are manipulative and fraudulent. As Minnesotans, we are committed to public health, to the civic good, and to the strength of the diversity of our identities. And so as a citizen, a faith leader, and a representative of my denomination, I ask that you endorse HF12 and protect our fellow Minnesotans to ensure that our great state offers a chance for all people to grow and flourish, each as they are, valuable citizens and beloved children of God. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Emily Zinos, followed by Jory Miller. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emily Zinos. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a founding member of Hands Across the Aisle, which is a global multi-partisan women's coalition. We urge the committee to oppose House File 12. Hands Across the Aisle members come from across the political spectrum, but though we disagree on a multitude of issues, our coalition collectively rejects the non-scientific notion that a child could be born in the wrong body. We believe that there is no such thing as a personality trait that requires drastic medical intervention. Our coalition looks forward to organizing ticketed events here in Minnesota, like conferences and panel discussions, and selling books and other educational materials that will challenge the notion that children need to undergo medical transition because of the toys they play with or the clothes that they want to wear. We want you to hear from researchers who have found that most trans-identified youth grow up to accept their sexual identity as male or female, and many of them are same-sex attracted. We want to give this stage to the mothers who can't find a therapist who will help their child learn to love their body as it is because they live in states with so-called conversion therapy bans. And we want the public to hear from the young women who have undergone cosmetic double mastectomies in high school because no one bothered to tell them it's okay to be a tomboy. If House File 12 becomes law, would selling tickets to events like these or paying the speakers expose our organization to charges of fraud? Would we be sued for consumer fraud under Section 3 of House File 12 because the state of Minnesota interprets those viewpoints as false or misleading or as intending to change a person's gender identity? This proposed legislation would stifle one of our coalition's key goals, a goal that every Minnesota legislator should welcome, which is to encourage our culture to recognize that every child is born in exactly the right body. Please oppose House File 12. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jory Miller, followed by Fred Hines. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Jory Miller. I am the son of third-generation North Dakota farmers. I had a beautiful childhood filled with love and compassion. However, when I was 15, my parents found photos of male models in my room. From a friend of a friend, they were referred to a pastor in a First Presbyterian church who claimed he had a solution to what others saw as a problem. Every Tuesday for about a year, I was sent to talk to this pastor, who also has a doctorate in psychology, about what they told me was for a porn addiction. He administered a modified version of Exodus International to cure my SSA, or same-sex attraction, and this fraudulent practice was mental torture. He consistently probed for sexual trauma, and I had never been abused. He disclosed inappropriate details about himself in an attempt to relate to a porn addiction I did not have. I was constantly manipulated into believing I had the power to change what he saw as perversions and that my sexuality was an illness. For a while, I attempted to buy in and believe those so-called treatments. I felt intense shame and guilt, and if I did not do everything I could to fix myself, no one around me would love me, and I completely failed my family. As the tools I was given to fix my sinful thoughts and behavior constantly ceased to cure me, I turned towards self-harm to fix everything wrong with me. I would stare at the men's section of a JCPenney catalog and grab an electric fence, praying I could hurt these thoughts out of my head. I had suicidal ideation during the Exodus International Base sessions and for quite a while after my time with this pastor. Conversion therapy has had harmful and long-term effects on my mental health, my personal relationships, and my journey to self-love. These practices were a complete fraud with nothing but negative outcomes. Today, I do not hate my parents, for they were also tricked by the church and the culture of rural America that there was a solution to cure their child of homosexuality and the struggles and embarrassment that my identity would bring. My hope is that no additional children will endure this mental abuse and feel as hopeless as I have. Conversion therapy does not work, and these services must end in Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Fred Hines, followed by Johann Baumeister. Welcome to the committee. You may state your name and proceed.
My name is Reverend Frederick Hintz. I serve as the public policy advocate for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and its roughly 180,000 members across the state of Minnesota. I have come to express our opposition to this bill. We oppose it, first of all, because we believe it attempts to use the anti-fraud statutes of this state in an inappropriate and unnecessary manner. It strikes us as odd that these particular advisory services are being singled out for special consideration when there is little evidence to indicate that this type of abuse occurs with any inordinate frequency or that it has caused any significant financial harm. At the heart of our objection to this bill, however, are two more profound concerns. The first of these relates to our firm conviction that this legislation amounts to a official and impermissible state endorsement of a particular worldview, a religious worldview, a worldview that rejects the understanding that human beings and their sexuality are part of a created order. Since the state is constitutionally obligated to take a position of neutrality when it comes to such religious matters, we believe it is entirely inappropriate for the state to make such an endorsement, which it seems to do in this legislation. Secondly, as a Christian church, we are concerned that this legislation will cause some of our fellow citizens to suffer unnecessarily because they will be deprived of the resources they need to pursue the vision of the good life, which for some means seeking relief from undesired same-sex attractions and deeply troubling gender dysphoria. Ultimately, it is out of concern for the welfare of our neighbor that we feel this proposal is ill-considered and will in fact cause much suffering. In fact, the same personal autonomy that is invoked by so many who would support this legislation is precisely the autonomy that would be denied to those who voluntarily seek this kind of assistance. Members of the committee, I urge you to reject this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Johann Baumeister, followed by Dale Witherington. And I appreciate everybody for correcting my pronunciations of your name, so my apologies. Welcome.
Thank you. You got mine right.
Thank you.
My name is Johann Baumeister. I've been, well, we used to call it different for as long as I can remember, and I didn't want to be for a very long time. I had loving and devoted parents who raised me in accord with their Lutheran faith, and one of the beliefs of our faith was that being gay was a moral failing and a terrible sin. And as a very young child, I knew I was different for as long as I can remember. I also knew that no matter how hard I tried, I could not change. My soul bears the scars of a terrible conflict between that belief and the knowledge that I did not choose to be gay and could not change. It wasn't until I joined the military that a chaplain told me that God doesn't make mistakes and that I was who I was meant to be and that I was meant to fail in my prior attempts to change. So I waited to come out until I had left my parents' home at the age of 19. I waited because I was no longer living at home and because I was safe. I knew that my home wouldn't be taken out from under me or I wouldn't be threatened with the loss of my family and my home if I didn't submit to conversion therapy. And yet I do not bear my parents any ill will for their demand that I submit to this therapy because they were misled. My mother was told that it was her failing because she was too strong of a woman, too dominant. And I ask you if you've heard that criticism before, too. I don't imagine it feels good. My dad was told that it was because he wasn't a good enough protector because I suffered abuse as a child, which I didn't. The men in this room have probably felt the shame of failing their families in the past. No one is perfect. But my dad didn't deserve to feel that way. I've been through therapy for depression and anxiety. I have coping skills now. I am a productive member of society. But conversion therapy would have robbed me of that. Conversion therapy would have endangered me. And it did damage my relationship with my family. And it damaged them. I urge you to vote against this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
Sorry, in support of this bill.
And thank you for your clarification. Dale Witherington, followed by Reverend Dan Adolphson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reverend Dale Witherington. I'm the Chief Steward of Restore Minnesota. Within our affiliated network are more than 3,000 Minnesota churches and hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans from all walks of life. I'm writing hoping that you won't make a decision tonight that would unjustly cause me and others in our network to be criminally charged with consumer fraud, which would potentially send many of us to jail because of the current language in Section 3 of HF 12. None of us would support the kind of conversion therapy that we're hearing about tonight. It's the language that is contentious. Like many others, I travel the state of Minnesota speaking to religious, civic, and business groups about a message of hope, restoration for people who are feeling lost, hurting, and broken. At times, those feelings will impact every one of us and others whom we love, regardless of their race, color, their creed, or their sexual orientation. At those times when many of us feel lost, broken, and hurt, we need compassionate help. For some Minnesotans, that means seeking help through workshops, ticketed events, and the purchase of books, pamphlets, audios, and other resources that empower us to live according to the dictates of our conscience. Some Minnesotans will choose to have help in living the LGBTQ lifestyle. They are protected by law to do so. Other Minnesotans will choose help to live according to their biological sex at birth, even if they are dealing with same-sex attraction. HF 12 will deny that second group the right to seek help according to the way they wish to live, according to the dictates of their conscience. Shouldn't all Minnesotans have right and access to people and resource that can help them live the lives according to their wants, needs, and desires? HF 12 will deny many pastors, teachers, and public speakers the right to help these people. Please protect the rights of all Minnesotans. This bill is not about so-called conversion therapy. It is about stopping professionals from bringing the exact help that the Minnesotans are requesting. It is about government overreach. Government politicians should not dictate nor restrict the rights of Minnesotans to receive their help that they choose. Thank you.
Thank you. Reverend Dan Adolphson, and followed by Sue Halverson. Welcome to the committee. Please correct my pronunciation.
You got it right the second time. Good evening, Madam Chair and honored members of the committee. I am Reverend Daniel Adolphson, Associate Pastor of First Christian Church Disciples of Christ in the Whittier neighborhood of Minneapolis, a member of the Upper Midwest region of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, past moderator of Disciples LGBTQ Plus Alliance, and a proud out gay man called by God to serve God's people. At First Christian Church, we are deeply involved in supporting LGBTQ youth in the Twin Cities, whether it be partnerships with a variety of organizations or through having a public presence at the Twin Cities Pride Festival each June. For many years, we were looked at with suspicion, a church that supports queer youth and their families. After hearing that statement one time too many, I started asking questions. I asked a lot of questions, and the stories I heard were heartbreaking and had the same theme. Over and over again, I heard from queer youth or their families about interactions with faith communities that in the moment when they should have heard the words, "You are fearfully and wonderfully made and beautiful as you are," instead they were told they were broken, they were damaged goods that needed to be fixed, and oh, by the way, we've got just the repair ticket for you. The repair promise of conversion therapy endangers those families, sometimes irreparably. It also harms and defrauds young adults who paid thousands of dollars for treatments with no scientific credibility. LGBTQ youth who'd experienced conversion therapy are 8.4 times more likely to attempt suicide, experience depression, isolation, and substance abuse. I know firsthand the damage a person being told again and again by a faith community that they are less than can do to a person's self-worth and self-esteem, as I spent many years in reparative counseling myself, trying to have something repaired that didn't need fixing in the first place. As faith leaders, we are called to minister to people in ways that protect them from harm. Madam Chair and members of this committee, I ask you to support House File 12 as it protects our LGBTQ citizens and their families from a practice that simply cannot deliver of the promise it makes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sue Halverson, followed by Pastor Dwayne Davis. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Okay. I'm Sue Halverson, and I'm a concerned citizen, and thank you for having me here today. I'm here not to give my own personal testimony, but I brought a packet that's put out by the National Task Force for Therapeutic Equality, and I love this packet. It's a little longer, but it's organized so well that it's got 10 bullet points why they oppose this bill, and then if you want more information, you can go directly to that portion of the document to find. It's got court case rulings, professional organization statements, and scientific studies. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halverson. And for members' reference, there is a stapled packet in your packet that bears Ms. Halverson's name. So you should be able to find that. Okay. Oh, it sounds like we don't have Pastor Davis. We'll just move on to we'll move on to Kathleen Nidiger, followed by Dexter Hansen. And I don't see Kathleen. Mr. Hansen is coming down, followed by Roger Sanchez. No. Somebody, that was a trick. let's see. Roger Sanchez? Got one. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Roger Sanchez. I'm a resident here in Minnesota and registered voter. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I was born into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church. At the age of 14, I was confronted by my father about being gay. Since it was against my religion, I denied it. A few years later, I acknowledged my sexual orientation and was told it could be cured. My church bishop recommended conversion therapy. Being young, I did not know much and did not have an extensive knowledge in regards to the matter. So like a lamb to the slaughter, I consented. What followed were years of torment and mental torture. I met with a therapist who tried to rewire me. I hated myself, and I was suffering in quiet desperation. It wasn't until I confided in a close friend who gave me a lifeline. I was connected with a counselor and therapist who affirmed that there was nothing wrong with me. It took years to embrace and love myself. My family is learning and has embraced me. However, I consider myself as one of the lucky ones because many do not make it due to substance abuse and suicide. There are many currently suffering in quiet desperation. If we can avoid any hurt, let's do it. Please support HF12. And I would also note that a similar bill was presented in Utah and the LDS Church supported it, that they, you know, it doesn't infringe on religious freedom. And also recently, a conversion therapist in Utah who practiced conversion therapy for over 20 years came out as gay and has denounced the practice.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mara Glupka. And after this final testifier, this is the last testifier who signed up. We do still have a few minutes left of public testimony, so if people want to let the committee page know that you'd like to testify, we can take some additional public testimony. The committee page is right over there, Kyle, just so you know. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mara Glupka. And thank you for this opportunity to speak. I live in Richfield currently, but I'm from Winona. I'm transgender. My awareness of that goes back to the age of 3 or 4. And by 4, I was told that I was a boy and that's it. At 15, my mother discovered a small collection of things that led to a very uncomfortable conversation with my parents where I explained that I couldn't make wishing that I was a girl go away. So they arranged for some help with counseling sessions at Catholic Charities. I knew the score going into counseling. I had zero choice but to go, and I was to come out cured. I played along with my counselor, and my counselor offered up that most people go through phases like this, and it just goes away. I jumped all over that and began to earnestly assert that it was just a phase and didn't need any more help, just to get out of it. This is the way I remembered it for most of my life. It was tough me outsmarting them. 6 years ago, my transgender therapist used a relaxation technique for reviewing parts of my life. We got to the Catholic Charities event, and I fell apart. I now realize that just the act of putting someone like me into a program designed to fix how I was, how I am, is a cruel and painful rejection. Suicidal thoughts were a regular visitor after Catholic Charities. An article in Psychology Today, dated November 14th last year, said that LGBTQ youth aged 13 to 19 were 3 times more likely to attempt suicide if their parents tried to cure them, and 5 times more likely if a religious leader or a licensed therapist was hired to cure them. And Dr. Robert Spitzer, who is the consensus founder of conversion therapy, wrote an apology to the LGBTQ community back in 2012 for all the harm that he caused. I urge you to pass this bill and stop hurting kids.
Thank you for your testimony. If you have checked in with the page for additional public testimony, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. We'll continue with the same rules that we are going to stick to 2 minutes per testifier and try to stay to Section 3 of the bill about advertising sales and misrepresentation of conversion therapy. Welcome. State your name and proceed.
I'm Joshua Kavanaugh, and thank you very much, Hunter, for bringing up this topic. Definitely a very important topic. And I thought that it would be worthwhile to talk about some of the things that go on in bona fide conversion therapy. I had both professional therapy as well as therapy offered by pastors. So I really appreciated the different things that I learned, and I'm a father of one with my wife who's here today with me, and I very much appreciate her. I'll state that I was strongly attracted to men before I initiated therapy, and that's not an issue for me. And by that, I would say that, like, it's not something that's even on my radar, like, you know, most months, like. And so that's an outcome, right? And so what did it look like? It looked like learning how to be independent, how to appreciate who I was. It looked like learning what love looked like. It looked like learning how to be the social person that I was created to be, how to truly connect with friends. And I am absolutely in appreciation for the people who worked with me on that, for my many good friends, and then for the mentors and health therapists who did this with me. And again, thank you so much for bringing up this topic, Hunter.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there another testifier who has checked in with the page? Welcome to the committee. Thank you. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Peggy Doherty from St. Paul, and I'm asking you today to oppose House File 12. I lived in a same-sex relationship for 18 years of my life and was in therapy on and off that entire time. I struggled with depression, anxiety, which I took medication for, and suicidal thoughts. When I was seeking therapists, I wanted to find one that would encourage me and empower me, and someone that would help me to wrestle with my thoughts and my fears. I was not looking for someone who wanted to change me, but someone who would help me know myself. Over the years, I saw a lesbian therapist who changed my life. She didn't push an agenda on me. She let me. She didn't tell me I was a lesbian just because I experienced same-sex attractions. Instead, she let me talk about my struggles of unwanted same-sex attractions freely. She allowed me to ask questions, and she helped me to dig deep into how my life experiences were affecting my thoughts and feelings. My therapist had the freedom to allow me to set my own goals, and that's why I no longer identify as a lesbian. I no longer take depression or anxiety medication, and I live a very healthy and satisfying life. House File 12 would put a political agenda ahead of people like me. We live in a culture today that allows men and women to change their bodies according to their genders and how they identify. Why shouldn't we be allowed to change our minds? Please vote no on this bill. Our kids deserve it.
Thank you for your testimony. Whoever signed up next. Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed with your testimony, and you can watch Amy for time. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. My name is David Hall. I live in Hudson, Wisconsin, but I was a longtime resident of Robbinsdale, Minnesota. I grew up in St. Cloud, and I benefited extremely from the Ministry of Outpost Ministries and from professional therapy regarding this bill. What I found very interesting in this discussion tonight and the discussion the previous committee was the language that Representative Hunter Cantrell has said, that this is not directed towards religious organizations. But the only testimony that we have heard from those encouraging the support of this bill have been from people who have unfortunately received very bad religious therapy, very bad religious advice, and very bad religious direction. So what is this bill meant to accomplish, if not the silencing of someone's deeply held religious beliefs? We have not heard from testimonies of bad therapists. And if it were so that there were, they would have gone to the professional organizations that support this bill. That seems like a contradiction to me. That seems to me that those, if there were such cases, would go first to those professional bodies and not waste the time of this honored and hallowed organization. I oppose this bill because it doesn't make any sense for this bill to be even considered, even be written. It seems to me that there's nothing good that will come of this bill. And as we've seen, it's created quite a bit of contention already in our state, in this state, and across the nation. And so I thoroughly and vehemently oppose this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Matthew Sullivan, and I'm currently pursuing a doctorate of veterinary medicine, a master's of public health, and a certificate of diversity and equity through the University of Minnesota and the Purdue University. I felt called to come down here right now in support of this bill. I was raised as a Catholic and still identify as a Catholic. And through the church that I grew up in, I had a lot of backlash as coming out as a gay individual at the age of 14. I still to this day have dreams of being a heterosexual man, but I know from hearing stories and doing my research on conversion therapy as it was presented to me as a child that that would not affect my life in a positive manner. Just due to the external pressures and backlash and homophobia that I experienced as a child, I deal with depression, anxiety, and many other fun mental disorders on a daily basis. And I have been to therapy, and I benefited from true therapies that helped me deal with those disorders that came from the homophobia that I experienced as a child and to this day. And hearing the different stories today made me feel compelled to say that if I also went through some of the treatments that was presented to people with conversion therapy hopes, I do not think I would be here today due to the suicide ideation that I can only imagine be exponentiated in the same sense of the people who have presented today. So I support this bill, and I urge the support as well as somebody who believes that we all dream in some sort to be normal, but that this type of conversion therapy would only exacerbate the negative aspects of what I'm already experiencing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, please. Thank you. My name is Luca Joe Grappoli. I'm a citizen of St. Paul here. Thank you so much for letting me share a minute of your time. I want to apologize to all the people who were injured. That's horrible that people should be hurt when they're seeking help. And I was a person who got help with a plethora of problems. And I grew up not knowing about God or religion. I really didn't care about God at the time. I spent most of my life as a lesbian, almost had a sex change, and was transgender. And I found a lot of acceptance in the gay community, and that was very welcoming. And but I always felt like there was something still wrong in me, and I couldn't figure it out. And then one day somebody told me, it was a pastor who sat me down, and he told me, he said, this is God's plan, to be fruitful and multiply, to fulfill the earth and subdue it. And he said, if you continue to live this way, you could end up in hell. And I said, okay. I was mad, and I went and researched it, and I found out he might be true, but why not find out? So the one thing that I just found to be interesting is that I didn't have any desire to stop being gay, none whatsoever. I was happy in my 30-plus years of living as a lesbian with women. And but what something happened to me when the girlfriend I was living with at the time made me go to church. And thank you. And when I got there, something happened in me, and I was met by a God who loved me. And it was in that love that I surrendered my life to him, and in that I became a different person. And I don't struggle with same-sex attraction anymore. It's not about me trying to change. It's about giving my life to the one who says, I love you. Let's have something better in your life. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Can come on down. Thank you. Looks like we have time for two more people, so welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Jacob Thomas. I am here in support of this bill. Clearly was not planning to testify, but since we have time, I will say my kind of journey through conversion therapy and becoming an out and proud gay man took a different turn than some of my friends and colleagues here. I grew up in the South in a very religious home, like Junior and others who have testified here. Yet when I was forced to kind of deal with this with my parents at 15, when they found a love letter from my best friend, Cody, I lied through my teeth because I knew exactly what would happen. I knew that I would be sent to conversion therapies. And even with lying to my parents to ensure that I did not do that, I was still forced to go to the pastor of my church and explain to him why I was a happy heterosexual man, and explain to my principal at a Christian school that I was a proud, happy heterosexual man and that he didn't love men. That was completely false. To try and prove that I could be straight, I joined the military for 8 years and was honorably discharged in 2016 from the United States Air Force. And I also married a woman and tried to run a church. The harm that conversion therapy has on our lives as LGBTQ people is something that no matter how we think of this, we should not allow that to be a medical practice in this state. It is unconscionable that we are even debating unethical practices to be allowed into our medical system. So I urge you to please support HF 12, pass it on to the larger committee, or onto the larger body. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to come up on the last 2 minutes of the public testimony, so you get to bring us home. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Jamie Maxey. I am a St. Paul resident, and I oppose this bill. I wasn't planning on sharing tonight, but I just kind of want to ask everybody who has ever kind of been stuck like inside of a closet, whether it's with your sexuality or whether it's with your gender, that you just take a step back and just think about that feeling. Like, how did you feel when you were questioning whether or not you were gay? Just think about that for a second. When I look back at that, I just remember being terrified. I remember Googling like what it meant to be gay. And, like, I really never, like, had anybody to, like, talk to. Because I grew up in Western Nebraska, super conservative rural area. And Google was my only answer. And I Googled it, and it told me I was born that way, and I was out and proud. I remember coming to Minnesota to meet up with my brother. And he lives in a Christian community. And what I expected was to get ridiculed, told I was going to hell because I was gay, that I was in a relationship with a woman. And what I experienced was totally different. I just felt loved and accepted. And I just want to apologize just on behalf of everybody who has had a negative and hurtful, abusive situation from this. That's not the way that God wants it. God wants you to know that you're loved and that he just wants to share his love for you. I feel strongly if you guys do pass this bill, you're going to be pushing people farther and farther back in that closet, or even pushing the people who have stepped out of homosexual attractions, that you would just be pushing them into the closet. You'd be making them afraid to share their stories, his of consumer fraud or whatever it might be. So I just really want you guys to think about that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And we've come to the end of the hour of public testimony. And at this time, we can move to member discussion. Questions from members? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cantrell. I told you I had concerns because I'm on the Central Minnesota Mental Health Board. And talked to the executive director quite a long time to kind of figure out what is this going to do to practices. And while he didn't think it would directly affect him, he's always expressed a concern that things could be misinterpreted. And by that, I mean, you know, there, somebody could make a statement and somebody could say, oh, it sounds like conversion therapy. And with that regard, I'm just really saddened that a place that does such good like Central Minnesota Mental Health Center would have to have that kind of fear, maybe, in how they treat folks. I just think it's something we really do need to think about. And the language, your amendment did help that a little bit, but I think they're still concerned. And I just wanted you to know that going forward. Thank you.
Representative Cantrell, you don't need to respond, but you may. That's all.
Representative Halverson, Chair Halverson, and Representative Tice, I appreciate you sharing those concerns. And would Dr. Sharmley have any feedback in that regard?
Welcome back to the committee. Just remind us of your name for the record and proceed.
Excuse me. My name is Dr. Margaret Sharmley, and I want to clear up some possible misconceptions about what this bill would do. As the American Psychological Association is a very big umbrella association and has divisions that include religious beliefs and practices. And so appropriate therapy does not tell people what they should be. It helps people explore some way to reconcile their distress and their feelings. So an appropriate therapist and mental health therapist would not tell somebody that you should be gay or you should be heterosexual. It simply allows people to explore their feelings and their conflicts. And I have to say that one of the hugest conflicts that people often come in the door with as a therapist is someone who is conflicted about their religious beliefs and their sexual orientation. It's a real concern, and those of us who practice ethically help people to sort of sort out and explore options in a way that helps them to better make peace and understand themselves. It doesn't say that you should be this or that. It helps people explore. So if people are saying that we encourage people to be gay, that's not true, nor do we encourage people to be straight. It's you know, who you are and how can you live with this. And the truth be known is that there are some people, this is a deeply held conflict for some people that doesn't get resolved, and some people do end up needing to live with some discomfort about this conflict within them. Other people find ways to come to peace with it, whether they accept their same gender or same sex feelings, or whether they change religions, or whether or not they don't act on their same gender feelings. There are many, many options for people to explore and come to grips with these feelings.
Thank you. Follow up, Representative Tice? Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to profoundly thank Representative Cantrell for bringing this bill and for all of the people who came here tonight and told their very difficult stories about their experiences. And I want to thank you on behalf of my friend Eric, who was the very first openly gay person I knew who was my own age and who died by suicide when I was a junior in high school and when he was a sophomore in high school. And suicide is a complicated thing, and there's never one answer. It's not that simple. Life isn't that simple. But I know, because I saw it with my own eyes, how badly Eric was hurt by the fact that he lived in a community that couldn't accept him for who he was. See, Eric and I both went to Coon Rapids High School, which is in Anoka-Hennepin school districts, and at the time there was a practice in Anoka-Hennepin that people who worked for the school district weren't allowed to teach that homosexuality was a valid lifestyle choice. And there was a deeply toxic atmosphere in the schools at that time. And some of you may know about that because actually after I graduated, the situation got worse to the point that there was a string of suicides and the district made national news because it was a suicide contagion area. And so later I was privileged and honored to represent five students who sued the school district over this issue, well, not conversion therapy, but over the issue of not lack of acceptance and preventing bullying and harassment. And I talked to so many kids in the course of that lawsuit about the disastrous consequences when someone's told that they are wrong for who they are and that there's something about them that needs to be fixed or changed. And so I couldn't be a stronger supporter of this bill. I'm so thrilled to vote for it in just a minute. I do want to clarify one thing for the committee and for anyone who's listening, because there was a lot of people who mentioned tonight in testimony the specter of criminal prosecution under Section 3 of this bill. Now, I'm a prosecutor. That's my profession. Section 3 does not create criminal liability, and it's just wrong to suggest that someone's going to go to jail under Section 3 here. And I really object to that, and because I don't think that that's what this bill is about, and I don't think that's what it should be about. But I will tell you that when I think back to my friend Eric, and when I close my eyes and I can see his face, I almost wish that it did, because I would love to have justice for him. I would love to have justice for all of the people who have been hurt for being told that they were wrong for who they were.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is one of those bills that a lot of times we come into committee and our minds aren't changed by anything. We come in with all the information y'all sent us ahead of time. We read through it. Or maybe we even made a decision before we got elected. But tonight, I had my mind changed by both sides, actually. All you folks that came forward and testified about how conversion therapy worked for you, that was compelling. And I believe you. And I appreciate you coming in here bravely and stating that. But I also failed to understand how much I would appreciate those folks who came forward to tell us how damaged they were by conversion therapy. And I also, Representative Cantrell, I told you before that, you know, I did have some reservations. Even though I thought conversion therapy was generally a bad idea based on the experiences we heard about, I thought that it was generally people's right in America to do bad ideas. However, this is restricted by folks younger than 18 or a vulnerable adult. And we have a storied history of enacting protections on behalf of those folks when we are in doubt. And the stories that I've heard from folks who experienced horrors of conversion therapy reminded me of experience that I remember when I was in college. I had some friends on campus who were in a group called the Rainbow Alliance, GLBTQ folks, and they were friends of mine, and they were political. And I was starting to get a little political back then, and one of the friends, A.B., was his name, was the president of the group. He said, "We're all going out to Washington." This was 1992, and it was the March on Washington, I believe the second one, LGBTQ March on Washington. They had the AIDS quilt out on the Capitol Mall. And they said, "We're going to go meet some representatives and senators and tell them about our issues. Do you want to come with?" And I thought, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. It's political. I was kind of had a budding interest in politics at the time, and I didn't see any issue with it. And in the weeks leading up to leaving, we had this big 15-passenger van we're going to travel out there with. I found out that my family, my girlfriend at the time, my parents, my friends, were freaking out big time. They were sure that I was going to go gay. Now, I'm still not sure what that means or what it meant, but they were absolutely convinced of it. I did not understand that that worry at the time, because I had no sense of how that could happen. I have always been interested in girls, and that's how it was back then, and never had any same-sex attraction whatsoever. So I was intrigued by having everyone who was close to me completely freaking out about this. Now, I did not go through what a lot of you who experienced the negative aspects of conversion therapy in protracted periods of time feeling alienated of your by your family and friends, but it was a short amount of time and it was acute, and I'm still to this day amazed by that alienation that I felt, and knowing at the time that when I was out there my girlfriend was watching the March on Washington on TV and was terribly worried, and my parents were watching it on TV pretty sure that I was going to come back gay. And what that tells me is that the reason why this bill is a good idea is because there are certain elements of this society that are so freaked out by things that they don't understand that we do have to enact this protection for folks
who are under 18 or who are vulnerable adults. Because that's the danger right now. Because some of you folks, and I respect the people of faith who came forward, and I respect your faiths. I'm Catholic. I grew up Catholic. I'm still Catholic. I'll always be Catholic, even after they excommunicate me, probably after this talk. But you have allowed a condition to continue that damages many of our young people. And maybe this will change in the future, and maybe we can change it back. But right now, there is damage going on, and I say jump ball goes to the kids and the vulnerable adults, so we have to enact this House File 12. Thank you, Representative Cantrell.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to compliment you for the way that you've run this hearing. This is an extremely provocative and deeply personal issue to many people, as we saw tonight. And the person who's sitting in that chair can guide a lot of how the behavior, the tone, the respect that takes place, and you've done an exceptional job tonight, and I just wanted to thank you for that. This is a very, this is a very personal issue to a lot of people, and we saw that on both sides, and I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Garofalo.
Oh, can I get a hearing on my bill?
In the Energy Committee?
No.
Madam Chair, yes or no?
I quietly said no under my additional discussion members. Seeing none, Representative Cantrell, you get the last word of the evening.
I want to thank you, Madam Chair, to echo Representative Garofalo's comments. The incredible and very balanced manner in which you conducted this hearing. For that, I'm immensely appreciative. I want to thank the members of this committee for giving us all the opportunity to talk about this deeply, deeply personal issue, to talk about an issue that for so many really is a matter of life or death. And lastly, I want to thank all the testifiers, whether you testified for or against this bill, because I believe that it is in the healthy exchange of ideas that the heart of our democracy grows stronger. So I just want to thank everybody. It's been a really incredible conversation this evening, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell, and I would just echo that. I also appreciate all the people who came to testify to tell their stories and their truths, and thank everybody for the time and the care that you've given to this bill. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 12 be re-referred to the general. House File 12 as amended. We're not coming back here. So I will renew my motion that House File 12 as amended be re-referred to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed say no.
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 The motion prevails, and you're on your way to the general register, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.